It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered a street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
It's not hot. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Happy Father's Day. I get to hear my dad's voice in the intro to the podcast every week. That was the last harassing phone call that we ever got from that real estate agent. I do miss the big guy. Unfortunately, there is a lot of disturbing stuff to get into on the podcast this week. This is Dark Side of the Ring, Sound Off Edition, episode 657 for Sunday, June 21st, 2020. But it's not all bad. In fact, one of the nicer moments of the week was watching CM Punk mark out like a little kid on WWE Backstage when he and Renee Young had the chance to interview Bret the Hitman Hart, who was on as their guest after FS1 aired the 1996 Survivor Series on Tuesday night, which featured the first ever pay-per-view meeting between Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin from Madison Square Garden. What a fun show. I came in, I would say, Tuesday night, probably 3 or 4 minutes into the Bret match. I didn't realize they were airing this pay-per-view. My brother had it on, and I just stopped what I was doing, and we watched the rest of the pay-per-view. And what a great match. You know, it gets overshadowed, obviously, by their WrestleMania match, and that was a better match, but this one was great too. And then you had Shawn Michaels against Psycho Sid for the WWF title. MSG going crazy for Sid, booing HBK out of the building. You could practically hear the sound of Vince McMahon's heart breaking into a million pieces. And then on Raw the next night, which is always fun to go back and watch if you want to dig it up on the network, the night after Survivor Series, there's this impassioned speech at ringside where the camera just zooms in on Vince McMahon, where he's defending Shawn Michaels. You would think that this was his son or his lover or something. He was just so, you could tell how devastated he was by the crowd reaction to this great babyface. But man, Sid was over like Rover during that run that he had when he came back to the company and he replaced the Warrior in the summer of 96, pretty much straight on until the fall. When he kind of, I guess, turned heel, although not really. I mean, he was still, doing the fist bump with fans. Fans were still cheering him. But obviously, through his actions, you could argue that, he was now a heel. But people loved him. People loved Sid. And it's funny, too, because Vader at one point was supposed to get that spot and probably the title at Survivor Series. And ultimately, that spot went to Sid. But just the atmosphere, when you watch that match and you watch that show, it's just unlike anything that you would see in modern-day WWE on television. I miss it. I miss it so much. But they talked to Bret about the match. And anyway, Punk thanked Bret for helping him become a professional wrestler because, and I was not aware of this, but Punk talked about how he was in the building that night in Chicago at the United Center for SummerSlam in 1994. That was the night that Bret wrestled Owen inside the steel cage. And I guess Punk was there in the building and still has very fond memories of that night. And so he thanked Bret. And look, you could say a lot of things about CM Punk. You could say a lot of things about Phil, but he's still a fan. You could see it on his face as he was talking to Bret. So I enjoyed that. I did enjoy that, and then the rest of the week happened, and everything just went straight to hell. So I'm going to get into some of these accusations, the releases, the suspensions, the resignations, and I have a lot to say about this whole situation as a whole. I don't even know if disturbing is really a strong enough word for it, but I got a lot to say about that, and I hope that this is a week, or this was a week, and it's not over yet. There's new things coming out seemingly every other hour. By the time this show goes up, there may be 5 new accusations for 5 different people. But my hope in sifting through all of this is that this was a week that we can look back on months from now, years from now, and say that things changed for the better. I don't know if that's just me being naive. I don't know if that's just me being overly optimistic. But that's my hope. I'm going to get into that. The COVID stuff with WWE. Not testing their talent. Came back to bite them on the ass this week. And deservedly so. I got a lot to say about that. Undertaker, he continues to make the media rounds. Today's the day. The big finale. Undertaker, The Last Ride. I haven't watched it yet. I plan on doing so once I'm done here, finishing this podcast in about 8.5 hours. But he continues to make the rounds, and he had some interesting things to say in some interviews he gave this week. Mike Chioda, right, who had been the longest tenured referee in WWE, who was fired after 35 years in the company a couple of months ago. He was on Talk is Jericho. He did his very first podcast appearance this week. How did that go? We'll talk about all that. But first, Audible, keep showing him some love, because every time you do, you help this podcast out. Whether you use the link, if you give the link to a friend or family member who you know might be able to use it, audibletrial.com/solomonster. audibletrial.com/solomonster. They are the one sponsor who has stuck with me through this pandemic stuff. Everybody else was kind of chased away or had to fall off. But Audible is still a big supporter of the podcast. You can get one free audiobook of your choice. There are a ton of great wrestling books you can choose from. It doesn't have to be wrestling. But if you want to cash in, sign up for a trial, use our link, and get your free book, audibletrial.com/solomonster. And of course, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, you may do so. At thesolomonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. First, I want to wish a very happy Father's Day to my very close, dear, personal, longtime friend, Brian Blade. Bet you haven't heard that name in a while. Brian Blade, and also congrats on the birth of his bouncing new baby boy, Aiden Joseph Blade, or AJ Blade. He is destined to be a wrestler with a name like that. AJ Blade, come on. Anyway, I can't wait to see you both. Hopefully sometime before I turn 40 at this rate. That would be nice if we could all get together at some point. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, 1 year ago, this man got engaged over in Italy. And here we are 1 year later. And on Thursday, he is finally tying the knot. He is getting married to his beautiful fiance. So I want to wish them both congratulations. My best to the both of you. May your union last longer than Lashley and Lana. Also, thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Mike, thank you, brother, and a shout out again to Bender, Metalhead Michael Babers, DeVenom John Eru, John Raging Mad Riffle, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine. I think I already mentioned him. I'm going to mention him twice. Because it was so nice. Harrison, thank you. Raging Mad Riffle. Josh the Shooter Stockton. The instant icon Taylor May. Happy birthday to his fiance Casey, who turns 28 on June 27th. It's too bad it wasn't like 1 day later. You're turning 28 on the 28th. Anyway, I hope you have a fantastic day. King Keeks. Enrique Hernandez. First time donator, long time listener. Love hearing that. Sepia Prince, who just bought a Rumble Like It's 1992 shirt from our store on ProWrestlingTees.com and says it looks great. So I hope you wear it out this summer. Wear it out this summer. Enjoy it. I got one myself laying around here somewhere. Powerful Pierre Degagne, also a longtime listener from south of the border, west of the sun. See how many of you can figure out where he is. He gave up on WWE after the first Saudi show and has not looked back since, but he watches AEW and he keeps up with everything via the Sound Off. So shout out to Pierre. Ryan Gonzi and his son Rylan, they call themselves the Rabid Bulldogs. Got to show them some love. Belt fan Brent Banner, this Thursday will be 25 years since the worst King of the Ring. I think this is just objectively the worst King of the Ring pay-per-view in the history of King of the Ring pay-per-views. King of the Ring 1995. And so to commemorate this, his two drink minimum YouTube channel, youtube.com/surreal469, if you want to pay them a visit, they're going to be dropping a new video reviewing this abomination on the anniversary of the pay-per-view. He's also done reviews of the best King of the Ring. He says 1994. He says 1993 is a close second. That is also available. See, I thought we were friends. And then you go and make a statement like that. But I'll allow it. I don't have to agree with it, but I'll allow it. So give his channel a look. And last but not least, just many thanks to Daniel in Ireland for being the very first person to give the sound off a review on Podcast Addict. That is very cool. And Mad Dog, MadDog7807 for the 5 stars on iTunes. I salute you. Thank you, sir. I thought the two main events last Sunday at Backlash delivered. I know not everybody is up on the YouTube channel, so I just want to mention this real quickly. I thought that the two main events were quite good. The rest of the show was largely just a waste of time. I thought Drew McIntyre and Bobby Lashley had a very good WWE Championship match, Edge and Randy Orton. Not the greatest wrestling match ever, but they had an excellent match with some cinematic elements and some new camera angles. Piped in crowd noise was distracting, but in the end, Randy Orton wins with the punt kick. He dusted off the punt kick for the occasion. No surprise, Orton went over. I had Orton winning, you know, when I did the predictions. It just made more sense. It made more sense than Edge winning, and not just because Edge won round one at WrestleMania. Edge didn't have to win this match. All he had to do was hang with Orton, and he did for, I think it went roughly 45 minutes from bell to bell. Or maybe that included the entrances, but this match ran as long or longer than their WrestleMania match, but I enjoyed this one more. They weren't handcuffed by the last man standing stipulation, and a lot of stalling and crying. Did they overdo it on the near falls? Yes. But I enjoyed the match. I enjoyed the match. So did The Undertaker. Undertaker said it almost brought a tear to his eye. Unfortunately, Edge tore his triceps. Even worse, he tore his triceps on a reshoot of a spot that never even aired. Which is why it was... I'm watching the match thinking, okay, I gotta see, where did he get hurt? Where did the injury take place? And I couldn't pinpoint it. It wasn't evident where the injury happened. And now I know why. Because the footage probably never even aired. He got hurt on a spot that never even aired. It wasn't even originally a part of the match. That makes it even more maddening. The idea that he got through the match and someone was like, hey, reshoot that. And then boom, he tears his triceps. And now the guy is probably gone for at least six to nine months for a spot they never even used. He had surgery last week before the match even aired. Before the match even aired on pay-per-view, he had already had surgery. He didn't tell anybody. I would be shocked if we saw him back in a ring this year. I think we're looking at Royal Rumble for a return if he's ready. Maybe one final match with Orton at WrestleMania next year. I don't even know that we need to have a third match, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, I'd like to see Edge in there because, you know, Edge doesn't have a lot of matches left, right? He's not. I don't think we're going to see Edge mixing it up with everybody on the roster. He's not going to be wrestling on every pay-per-view. He's not getting any younger. I would like to see him in there with guys that I haven't seen him in the ring with before, like an AJ Styles or like a Daniel Bryan or even a Kevin Owens, fellow Canadian. But he'll be back. I know there's some debate. Is he even going to be able to make it back? He'll be back. He'll be back. I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, he can go out with the greatest wrestling match ever. And everybody had all this great praise for the match. Even though he lost, you know, what a great match to go out on. But again, to go out with an injury. We're right back where he was in 2011, where his career ended on an injury. And now again, he gets injured and he's not going to come back. I don't see it. I don't see it. For all the money that he is being paid on that contract, supposedly, there's no way he's not coming back. But I just don't see it being this year. And in something that I don't think I have ever seen before, I know this has happened at least once with, or maybe even a few times with Raw polls on, that I do on Twitter with SmackDown polls over the years. Never with a pay-per-view, I don't think. We had a dead even split in our Twitter poll results for Backlash. 50% thumbs up, 50% thumbs down. And that's with over 3,600 votes. We're not talking a few dozen votes or a few hundred votes. 3,600 plus votes, which is actually a little low for a pay-per-view poll, but that's still a lot of votes. A dead heat. The most polarizing WWE show of the year so far is Backlash 2020. Now, this has been a dark week for pro wrestling, for British wrestling especially, but this is hardly a problem limited to the UK wrestling scene. It is not a stretch to say that there have been over the years, and still are, a lot of scummy people and shady characters in the professional wrestling business. And look, I suppose you could say the same thing about a lot of sports and other forms of entertainment, the movie industry, the music industry. But wrestling just seems to be in a category all on its own. I don't know if people think they can just get away with things more easily because it's wrestling and it falls under the radar. You know, people are worried about their careers or their pushes. They're less likely to speak up, you know, about these sorts of things. But whether it's promoters, trainers, talent, there are some really shitty human beings that will take advantage of men and women. It's not just one gender. Men and women. Exploit them. Even abuse them. Some have been outed over the years. Many have not. Others, you hear rumors and stories about, you know, but that's all they are, rumors and stories, unless somebody is brave enough to actually put their name on it, which can't be an easy thing for them to do. You can understand why. You know, especially when you see the reaction on social media that I saw from people over the last several days. It is no wonder that people are scared to speak up and come forward and say anything. Through a hashtag called Speaking Out, this is the Speaking Out campaign, dozens of women and even some men, I mean, a lot of people, dozens of people within the wrestling business, current wrestlers, former wrestlers, have posted their own stories, making accusations, which is what they are right now, accusations of sexual harassment, accusations of intimidation, accusations of even sexual abuse and rape that they have endured from people in the wrestling business and even from some pretty prominent figures, names that you and I would recognize instantly in the wrestling business. Some of the stories date back years. Sometimes all it takes is one. All it takes is one person to open up the floodgates and get the dominoes falling, and that's exactly what happened with David Starr, who has been a big name on the independent scene now for the past few years, and an ex-girlfriend of his who came forward this week. Now, I am not going to read off every single name. There's so many of them. Every single name, every single allegation. I'm singling out a bunch of them, a group of them, a batch of them, because I do think it's an important story that needs to be covered. It can't be ignored. It has blown up into a huge deal. To ignore it is to just bury one's head in the sand, and I'm not going to do that. But in this case, David Starr, he responded to it. He's one of the few that actually, and he was the first, to respond to the allegations against him. He's the one that got all of this started. In some other cases, we've had WWE come out publicly and issue, and other promotions have issued statements of their own. They've released certain talents. They've suspended certain talents indefinitely. There's already a lot of changes happening. One of these examples that I'll get into could potentially even wind up sinking an entire promotion. One that I've reviewed here on this podcast. That is certainly newsworthy. Now, the ex-girlfriend in question is a lady named Victoria. She included screenshots of conversations between herself and David Starr dating back to 2016 and accused him of sexual abuse. She has accused him of rape. Let's call it what it is. Now, for those who don't know, David Starr is known for being very vocal about wanting to unionize the wrestling business He sort of became, in a way, the de facto face or spokesperson for that movement. Vice.com did a whole article on him at the beginning of the year about how he wants to bring socialism to the pro wrestling business. I know he was very outspoken, you know, politically on his page and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, whatever. But he had a WWE tryout many years ago that didn't go anywhere. The last several years, he's become a mainstay in different European promotions. Rev Pro, Progress, OTT Wrestling. He upset WWE last year. He had a match with Walter, who at the time was the United Kingdom champion. And he had a match with him. He had stepped on the United Kingdom title. I guess they wanted to do something to get people talking. He stepped on the title. WWE got wind of it. They were pissed. They were not happy about that. But he always came across as this very virtuous guy, you know, wanting to help. He wanted to help bring about change to the wrestling business. Change for the better. But if this woman and others are to be believed, in reality, he was a fucking scumbag. Which is a shame, because the idea of unionizing and taking better care of the talent, you know, better care of the wrestlers, it's a great idea. Right? His scummy behavior does not invalidate some of the great ideas that he was, you know, so vocal about. Unfortunately, he's just the wrong spokesperson for it. The star has since deactivated his Twitter account, which is probably wise, but he did post a statement before doing so, which did not help his cause. He admitted to being a shitty partner, but he denied being a sexual predator. This is the Cliff Notes version of what he said here. He said, I've done plenty of wrong in my life, especially regarding my relationships with my partners. I am not a predator, but I have been an emotionally immature dickhead to my partners, Victoria especially. I will not go on the offensive. I can't take away the lying and cheating. I can't take away the emotional and mental pain that I've caused my partners and myself. I can make sure it doesn't happen again. I've accepted my wrongs and whatever those consequences are. No excuses. But I am not a sexual predator. I did a lot of research on the topic of gray rape after discussing with multiple victims of sexual assault. Yes, gray rape. Gray rape, for those who don't know, is a term used by some people to describe sex where consent is unclear, which sounds exactly like the sort of thing you would expect a rapist would say, which, again, is what he is accused of. This entire letter that he wrote was so condescending. If it was meant to be an apology, and I don't know if it was or not, but if it was meant to be an apology, it is the worst apology that I have ever read. Says, at no point did I ever think I was violating you, but that still doesn't mean I didn't. At no point did I think that something was non-consensual, but that doesn't mean it was consensual. A lack of a verbalized no does not mean consent. The fact that we were dating and had sex multiple times before and after the incident does not mean that every sexual act between us was consensual. Even though we had sex multiple times that night does not invalidate your experience. Just because you expressed sexual desires for me after the incident didn't vocalize your experience to me and held those feelings in doesn't mean that your experience is not a reality or that my actions were not acceptable. Good grief. Good grief. Pete Dunne is one person who is very outspoken, and good for him. He's very outspoken on Twitter this week, especially about David Starr and his words being full of it, and about David Starr not really caring about any of the stuff that he claimed to be such an advocate for. He said, I'm disgusted by what I'm reading. Well done to those speaking out. I really hope we can make British wrestling a better place and keep everybody safe. This is a huge eye-opener, and let's hope it will force a big change. And when somebody in the replies accused Dunne of staying silent on the subject, he said, for the record, I had no clue that David Starr was a sexual predator. If I did, he would not have been anywhere near a locker room that I was in. I did, however, find him to be full of shit. A lot of others thought that, by the way. I was probably the only one with a following big enough to speak out about it due to the popularity that he had gained for a cause that he didn't really care for. He made some good points, in all honesty. It's a shame it was only for personal gain. And then later on he tweeted, I can't believe I have to say this, But as I am reading more and more accusations towards people involved in British wrestling, it doesn't matter if I had issues with the abusers in question already or if I consider them a friend. Independent, AEW, or NXT UK, all equally disgusting. I urge people to use whatever platform they have now to show support. Cynical tweets, assuming there will be silence if someone's part of the same brand, is just a waste. A second ex-girlfriend of Stars named Bella has also since come forward with allegations of sexual assault, so I guess this Victoria lady is not the only one. Multiple groups have since already cut ties with David Starr. OTT Wrestling stripped him of their top title. Rev Pro and TNT Extreme Wrestling have followed suit. Rev Pro has vacated its Southside Championship as a result. Beyond Wrestling here in the States has said it will never work with him again. And We the Independent, which is a group devoted to unionizing pro wrestling, has announced they will no longer work with him either. I think it's safe to say that David Starr has probably made enemies out of a fair number of promoters being so open and so vocal about the whole unionization issue. So he was already on their shit list, even before all of this. He's going to have a very tough time finding any promoter who wants to do business with him anytime in the near future. Jack Gallagher, who was brought in by WWE as part of the Cruiserweight Classic several years ago. Gentleman Jack Gallagher. He had spent time more recently on the 205 Live roster. He was accused of sexual assault at a New Year's Eve party in 2014, 2 years before he joined WWE. So not that long before he joined the company. He was accused by a woman who said that Gallagher tried to get her drunk, made several advances despite being told no, and then burst into a bathroom and ripped her skirt down before she was able to leave. She later tweeted a DM conversation between Gallagher and the person who owned the house where the party was held, claiming that he has no recollection of what happened. He was mortified by it. He wanted to apologize to her. She wasn't interested in hearing his apology. There was another anonymous person who came forward submitting her own story accusing Gallagher of sex assault in an unrelated incident. On Friday night, WWE posted a very terse one-line statement announcing his release from the company, stating WWE has come to terms on the release of Jack Gallagher, real name Jack Claffey. And that was it. That was the entirety of the statement. They didn't even wish him well in his future endeavors, which is very telling. Gentleman Jack turned out to not be such a gentleman after all. And so far, he is the only one to be released by WWE. He may not be the last. Matt Riddle. Matt Riddle made his SmackDown debut on Friday night. He interrupted AJ Styles and his Intercontinental Championship celebration, which led to an impromptu match, non-title, between the two of them that Riddle won. All the members of the SmackDown roster that were surrounding the ring, you know, for the celebration had stayed for the match. It looked like a lumberjack match. They got inside afterwards to celebrate with Riddle and Drew Gulak's holding him up in the air. It felt like the coronation of a new star on the SmackDown brand. You would never know that earlier that same day, the man was accused of rape by another wrestler. But that's exactly what happened. Candy Cartwright, who has wrestled on and off for the Shine Wrestling promotion, and according to her Twitter bio, is the Evolve Wrestling social media ambassador, the Evolve Wrestling that apparently no longer exists. If reports are to be believed, it looks like WWE may have just bought up the bones. Evolve may be no more. But she accused Riddle of forcing her to have sex with him. She claims that back in May of 2018, she was riding with Riddle and a few other wrestlers in a van. And during that ride, when the other three wrestlers had fallen asleep, Riddle asked her to do something very explicit, sexually explicit. She said that she refused, although they had previously been together. She said that she was very uncomfortable in that setting. And when she said no, she claims that Riddle grabbed her by the throat and choked her and said, "What if I just made you?" And then she ended up giving him oral sex, praying that somebody in the van, you know, wouldn't wake up in the middle of all this. She did this to get out of having sex with him. This is what she claims. WWE later released the same statement for Riddle that they originally released for Jordan Devlin, another name I'm going to get into here. They put a statement out saying, "We take any allegation of this nature very seriously, and we are looking into the matter." Later, they issued a blanket statement for any and all allegations that reads as follows. They said, "Individuals are responsible for their own personal actions. WWE has zero tolerance for matters involving domestic violence, child abuse, and sexual assault. Upon arrest for such misconduct, a WWE talent will be immediately suspended. Upon conviction for such misconduct, a WWE talent will immediately be terminated. WWE's ability to fine, suspend, or terminate a talent will not be, however, limited or compromised in any manner in the event that incontrovertible evidence of such illegal misconduct is presented to WWE." Meaning that if somebody comes forward with just, you know, blatant evidence that something horrible happened, they don't have to wait for them to be arrested or for there to be a trial or anything like that. They are free to take whatever actions they feel that they need to take. Now, one of Riddle's Twitter followers released a direct message exchange with Riddle. He claims that Matt saw some of his tweets and Riddle DM'd him first and was very disappointed that he would believe the allegations. He claims that the woman accusing him has been harassing him now for years and forced him to change his phone number 3 times, and he almost took out a restraining order against her, but he claims he didn't do it because he didn't want to ruin her career. He claimed his lawyer and WWE are already in motion to press charges against her for defamation and cyberstalking. For what it's worth, Riddle's wife, Lisa, backs up his account. She backs up her husband's claims about having to change his phone number and almost filing a restraining order. Riddle's attorney later issued a press release. His Twitter profile looked like a fan account. I'm not even joking. I'm not trying to be funny. You know, when I heard Matt Riddle's lawyer has posted a statement, I was looking at a tweet and I thought that it was a fan who had, you know, maybe taken a screenshot of the press release and put it on their own Twitter page. And then I'm looking, I'm like, wait a minute, this is the lawyer. It looked like a fan account. It looked like just a regular page. It wasn't from like a law firm or anything. This is Matt Riddle's actual lawyer. Now, he had to pull the first tweet and repost it after people pointed out that he printed the press release on a sheet of labels. So he reposted it on actual printer paper the second time. You know, life comes at you fast, I guess, when you're rushing to put together a press release. I know that feeling. So the allegations by this independent female performer are completely false. In another attempt to harass and humiliate Mr. and Mrs. Riddle and try to tarnish their reputation in the community, we have been aware for the last 2 years of this performer stalking the Riddle family. In 2019, our firm had drafted a pleading against this performer to seek an injunction for cyber stalking in the Circuit Court for Orange County, Florida. Now, if you're getting into stuff like this, then that must mean there's a paper trail, and so that's going to be very interesting to see if, in fact, there is evidence that proves that there was stuff like this going on last year, and we'll see. Obviously, all the information is not out yet. Look, I see a lot of people on social media seem to have made up their minds that Matt Riddle is innocent because his lawyer put out a statement, which does not make him any more or less innocent than he was before that statement was issued. Now, if he did this, then he's a scumbag, and he should be fired. Plain and simple, he should not be working for WWE. He should not be working for any wrestling promotion. If he didn't do it, and what he and his wife says is true, and the woman has an axe to grind, then she should be charged with a crime. Because you cannot falsely accuse someone of rape and get away with it. The fact is, right now, we just don't have the answer. So let's not pass judgment and say, oh, obviously, you know, Riddle is innocent, Riddle is in the same situation he was in before the lawyer put the statement out. But if, in fact, there were things filed and things going on, then we'll wait and see, and that stuff should come out. Because, again, you can't have a situation where you lob an accusation like that against somebody just because, you know, you have an axe to grind, you have some kind of beef with them. And I'm not saying that's the case here, but it goes both ways. Unfortunately for him, all of this came on the day that he was making his big debut on the main roster. WWE ran the segment. It would have been hard for them not to because you know, if it, I almost feel like if he had just made his debut and it was just a match on the show, WWE probably would have pulled the segment. But the fact that he was so heavily involved in one of the key segments on the show that involved all these other wrestlers made it virtually, it's not impossible, but it made it virtually impossible for them to pull it. I'm not gonna go after them and castigate them and, you know, for that. Believe me, there's other stuff I'm gonna go after them for in a little bit. That's not one of them. We'll let it play out and see what happens. But, you know, yes, I've been a big Matt Riddle fan for a long time. If it comes out that he in fact did this, and the problem with a situation like this is we may never have a clear-cut answer, because if it boils down to he said, she said, then that may be where we're stuck. But if he did something like this, doesn't matter if I'm a fan of the person or not. That person has no business being in the wrestling industry. Plain and simple. Jordan Devlin, the reigning co-NXT Cruiserweight Champion. He was not spared either. After a woman named Hannah tweeted images of bruises on her body, attributing them to Devlin and writing, "This is scary, really scared. Jordan Devlin did this to me. And this is just the physical damage, not including my arse or my back bruises, because I don't fancy posting that online." After Devlin tweeted about his, or the idea that there would be a new chapter for OTT wrestling, because they had stripped David Starr. Remember how this all started? David Starr, right? So he tweeted that, oh, there's a new chapter now coming to OTT. You know, David Starr has been stripped of the world championship. Hannah then tweeted, "My head is full, but my abuser is now tweeting about OTT wrestling vacating their championship. You're in danger of putting another abuser right in Starr's place." You know, Shawn Michaels has been a big force behind NXT UK. You know, from all the stories and the accounts, it's as if Triple H has sort of handed the reins, the creative reins, over to Shawn Michaels, and he has really been running NXT UK. And he is said to be a huge fan. He has spoken very highly of Jordan Devlin. He won the Cruiserweight Championship back at the World Collide show in January. So a lot of high hopes in that company for Jordan Devlin as a performer. The pandemic has stranded him overseas, which is why they had a tournament to crown an interim Cruiserweight champion, which El Hijo del Fantasma won. He beat Drake Maverick in the finals. Now, of course, he's going by the name Santos Escobar, but that's why we have an interim Cruiserweight champion, why we have co-champions now. What this means for his future as the Cruiserweight champion is, or even his future with the company, is up in the air, but he has forcefully come out against the allegations, tweeting, "I did not even want to address the hurtful allegation made against me, but for the sake of my followers and friends on this platform that may for whatever reason be unsure, I'm going to address this once. The recent allegations made against me is completely and utterly false, and I deny it entirely. The recent allegation against me, this is a case, I should say, of a malicious personal agenda being executed against me on the back of a very brave telling of true experiences by other women. I completely denounce this. This is all I will say on the matter, and I'm now working with a legal team to help decide how to proceed from here." Another NXT UK star, Ligero, was accused of misconduct by multiple women and issued the following statement, and he talks about the story that's been released by this woman in question. Violet is her name. "Is neither accurate nor true. This is a completely false allegation. Whilst I have done other things in my life that I deeply regret, this is not an accurate or truthful portrayal of events. This is something I strongly deny and is something I've been in the process of speaking to a legal team about. Regarding other statements from people like Laura, Natalie, who have spoken out about the way they were made to feel, and others that have come forward and unwanted messages, I have no excuse. It is inappropriate, it's an embarrassment, and it's an absolute shameful way to act from someone in a position of trust. I sincerely apologize for my actions and any hurt that I have caused. I have no justification for my actions in the slightest. In these situations, I have failed people as a friend, as a fiancé, and as a decent human being." The assault allegation made by Violet claimed that Ligero indecently assaulted her after a Christmas party. Several other women have since accused him of sending inappropriate messages. One woman claims that he started messaging her when she was 17, and he was working as her trainer. So he denies the assault, but he admits to all of these other things. He admits to mistreating women in the past. He's also being attacked by his fellow NXT UK stars. Amir Jordan, right? Another NXT UK roster performer. He referred to Ligero as a bully and a manipulative liar who will go to the ends of the earth to protect himself. So now, even his own is turning against him. Then you have another NXT UK star, Travis Banks, was outed as having entered into a relationship with a 17-year-old girl that he was supposed to be providing wrestling training to. This is becoming a very disturbing pattern here with these young women. Young women in some cases that these people are supposed to be training and assisting and helping. They're doing a lot more than that. Progress Wrestling in the UK has announced that they will no longer be working with Travis Banks. They will no longer be working with Ligero or David Starr. They have suspended Jordan Devlin indefinitely and vacated their tag team titles that he held with Scotty Davis, who, oh, by the way, is also suspended indefinitely and is accused of a bunch of terrible shit. This is a cesspool, is what this is. Then there's NWA Vice President David Lagana, accused of sexual assault by a wrestler named Liz Savage, who alleges that there was an incident back in 2010 while she was staying with Lagana as a friend out in Los Angeles at his home. She said it was not sexual, but they were sharing a bed, which is, you know, I can understand why people would think that's a little strange, but they were sharing a bed, but it was nothing sexual. One night she woke up and she found him with his hand down her pants, touching himself. She pulled away from him. Less than a week later, with no notice, she says he kicked her out. Lagana has not commented publicly on the allegation. He has, however, resigned from his position as vice president of the National Wrestling Alliance. The NWA released a statement saying, pursuant to allegations made by pro wrestler Liz Savage on her Twitter account, NWA VP David Lagana has resigned from his position effective immediately. As well, all production of NWA content is temporarily halted pending a restructuring of executive management positions. So into the fire he goes. It may not be an admission of guilt, but it's probably going to come across that way to a lot of people. You can understand why. This was very disappointing. And it really makes me question the future of the NWA. And there's a lot of people who were employed by the NWA who now their livelihood or their positions anyway are potentially now in a state of jeopardy. Lagana was such a big part of that product and the production all the way back to the 10 Pounds of Gold series. Did a lot of good stuff. You know, from a creative standpoint, a content standpoint, editing. I mean, he was the one responsible for a lot of what we all saw. Which is why the NWA is now temporarily on hold until they can figure out who's going to be able to fill his shoes going forward. He wore many hats in that promotion. You know, they were producing episodes lately of their new Carnyland series on their YouTube channel during the break due to COVID. They have not run any shows in months, but before they can continue, they have to first find somebody who can fill that void and hope that they can get shows going again soon because, as Nick Aldis put it recently in an interview that he did, Billy Corgan is personally wealthy. Yes, he is. He has a lot of money, a lot of Smashing Pumpkins money. That Billy Corgan has, but he's not interested in throwing his money away. He's not going to throw his money at something until the end of time. It was going to be tough to survive long term the longer this shutdown dragged on anyway. This is even without losing somebody like Lagana. So if you're an NWA fan, I would think that you have to be concerned about the future of that company. Jimmy Havoc, his ex, shared stories on social media Thursday of the emotional trauma that she suffered while dating him. Other stories have since come out about him, which paint a very scary picture of Jimmy Havoc. On Friday, AEW released a statement. We wish Jimmy Havoc all the best as he receives treatment and counseling in an effort to overcome the mental health and substance abuse challenges in his life. We are aware of various reports related to Jimmy. We are evaluating his status with our company and will address it when he has successfully completed his rehab. Some of those reports they reference are pretty gross. I honestly wonder, you know what? I don't know anything. This is just me talking here. Sounds to me like he's done. AEW is just waiting for the right time to make it official. Maybe they want to wait for him to get through rehab. I don't know. I don't know where their mindset is on this. The man obviously has issues. The man obviously has done some shit. I think they want him to get help first, and then I think his future with AEW is, to say the least, very much in doubt. You ask me, I think he's done. I think he's gone. Joey Ryan of Impact Wrestling plays a sleazeball on TV and apparently plays one in real life too. Multiple accusations against Joey Ryan from different women and some things from different men that don't very much paint him in a flattering light either. He posted a response. He said that his lawyer has advised him not to respond to specific allegations at this time, but then he posted paragraphs taking responsibility for the shitty way he has treated people over the years and the way he has disrespected them, which prompted Joey Janela to absolutely bury his ass 6 feet under on Twitter. He eviscerated this guy, saying, "This dude is a lying sack of fucking shit. I used to be friends with Joey, but all the allegations against him now and that are about to come out about him, without a doubt, are 100% true." Now, you can never say that allegations that haven't come out yet are 100% true. For the record, let's just put that out there. But clearly, Joey Janela knows some stuff that we don't. MLW, I was trying to wrap up my notes, which has been an impossible task this week for this podcast. And as I was trying to do so, I saw MLW put a statement out announcing that they have released their ring announcer, Mark Adam Haggerty, who is also a ring announcer and someone who was involved pretty deeply, honestly, in the independent wrestling scene. A lot of people know who he is. Some people may never have heard the name before, but for MLW, he was their ring announcer. He has been fired. He has been released. This after screenshots surfaced that show him having inappropriate conversations with a 15-year-old child. And he allegedly knew the kid's age and that the kid had mentioned being a high school freshman at least more than once. That's the claim against him. MLW thought enough to cut all ties and let him go. Just, I can't even tell you. I cannot even articulate to you how many more accusations are out there. There have been more accusations levied against Velveteen Dream. That's a very bizarre situation. We never really got a resolution to all that stuff the first time. I know some people thought that it was debunked. I don't know that that's the case. We don't have a whole lot of clarification on exactly what's going on with Velveteen Dream, but now there's been more accusations against him. Accusations against Will Ospreay and his girlfriend, Bea Priestley, that they helped get a wrestler named Pollyanna blacklisted a few years ago from the UK scene. She had first retired, but then she had tried coming back. Couldn't get bookings anywhere. This was after she had come out and accused a good friend of Will's of sexual assault. Jim Cornette and his wife Stacy, they've been accused of using his power at the time as the booker of OVW to groom talent and get them to perform certain sex acts with his wife, and so many more. It just feels like an endless cycle these last few days. And the most disturbing part of this, I mean, there's a lot of disturbing parts of this, but maybe the most disturbing part of this is the sheer number of stories that have come out, that are still coming out, and that will no doubt continue to come out. And what it reveals, which is a very big problem in the wrestling business, and it's not limited only to the UK scene. I read about a lot of what these people are accused of doing, things that some of them have already copped to and apologized for, some things they deny, other things they admit to. You know, it's interesting that a lot of these different people, they will admit to things that they feel are, I guess, minor compared to the major things that they've been accused of. They didn't do the worst things, but they did all of these other things. And you can see why it becomes difficult to believe that in every single case that's the truth. They'll come out and say, my heart is with all these women as they come out and tell their stories, but I didn't do this thing that they accuse me of. And almost to a T, everybody seems to have said the same thing so far. So who's lying and who's telling the truth? Are all of these women, are we supposed to believe that all of these women are just making up these sexual assault claims? That all these other things and the messages, yeah, we did that, but oh my God, all these sexual assault claims, well, they're just complete bullshit. Are we supposed to believe that? If not, who's telling the truth and who's not? This whole thing is a complete clusterfuck. But, you know, if I had a son or if I had a daughter and I found out these things were happening to them, these people would be begging for a jail cell. They would be begging to be locked away so I couldn't get my hands on them. It is disgusting. It is appalling. It is disgusting. These things are not acceptable. They are never acceptable under any circumstances. I don't care who you are. Police in the UK are now officially investigating many of these claims, at least the UK-related ones. I hope somebody contacts law enforcement in this country and does the same. You know, that's my hope. That ultimately is up to the accusers and whether or not they want to go down that road. And that is their choice. They don't have to if they don't want to. It was, I'm sure, hard enough for many of them to go public with these claims. But I hope that somebody does and they get the authorities involved here, so we could try to sort through this whole mess. You know, with so many accounts coming out all at once, it's been hard. It's been hard to keep track of everything that's going on, all the names, all the allegations. There's been lists that have been floating around, at least one of which has been proven to be false. And that doesn't help matters. There was some kind of list floating around that had some of the names that I mentioned, and then other names that really had no business being on there, and then, you know, certain Twitter pages had to pull them down and apologize, and that's cool that they at least were able to do that, but that's a dangerous thing. That you have some people who are, maybe they're trying to intentionally sabotage this whole thing and they're starting to circulate fake names, I don't know, but, you know, it's a mess. And it's very frustrating because some of these cases, as I said before, are ultimately only going to just boil down to he said, she said. And it may well be that on some of these claims, there is no evidence. There is no text messages. There are no DMs. There is no physical evidence to back up some of these claims at the end of the day. But these people deserve to be heard. Now, if someone is accused of something, especially if they're accused of a crime, then they have the right to defend themselves. And if they deny it, and if they know that the other person is lying, then you have to get the authorities involved. You have to. No one wants to see somebody go down for something that they didn't do. That's not fair to that person either, and their friends and their family. Lives can be ruined. Now, a lot of the women that have spoken out, though, are still active in the wrestling business. They're still, you know, they're still wrestling. They're taking a very big risk coming forward with these stories. They're risking their livelihood. They're risking their future bookings. For them to come forward like this, it's a risk for them, too. And you have to stop and ask yourself, in a lot of these cases, I mean, what do they have to gain by doing something like this? You know, do people lie? Does it happen? Of course it happens. Unfortunately, there are some very deranged people in this world who will do things like that. Like circulate fake lists that I just mentioned. There are people who will do those things. But when you have multiple accusations being levied against one person by half a dozen people or more, it becomes a lot harder to believe that it's all just one big conspiracy against that person. It's the Bill Cosby thing, right? Who knew? Who knew that the man was such a monster? Well, I mean, apparently a lot of people knew in Hollywood for years. Or they suspected, and they did nothing about it. But that's beside the point. These situations, unfortunately, they play out in the world far more often than they should. One thing is for sure, this whole situation is a fucking mess. Now, if they did these things, then these people deserve to be publicly outed and shamed. And for the more serious allegations, those people need to be permanently exiled from the wrestling business. Full stop. You know, the physical abuse is bad enough. But all of the stuff with underage kids, and I don't want to hear, well, you know, in some places, 15 is the age of consent, 16 is the age of consent, 17 is the age of consent. I don't care. It's fucking sick. There should be zero tolerance with that kind of stuff. If I was a wrestler sharing a locker room with somebody who was accused of what some of these people are accused of, I would be mad as hell. But I would also be furious for being lumped in with people like that, because this paints all wrestlers now in a terrible light. This paints the whole wrestling industry in a horrible light, and the wrestling industry does it to itself a lot with some of the shit that goes on. This is not a new phenomenon. The wrestling business has been looked at like this for the better part of 30, 40, 50 years. But I would be furious if I was one of these wrestlers who actually, you know, was walking the straight and narrow, just doing my job. I love pro wrestling. I love what I do. And now they all get lumped in with all these scuzzballs. Shit like this should not be tolerated. And if you make excuses for it, you are part of the problem. If you assault someone, or if you use your power or your influence to intimidate people into doing what you want them to do, or you shame people into doing what you want them to do, you are a piece of shit. And you do not deserve to share a ring or a locker room with other wrestlers that actually know how to behave like decent human beings. And there are a lot of them. There are a lot of good people in the pro wrestling business. I said this on Twitter. There is a lot of smoke right now to these fires. Some of them burn brighter than others. For the more serious accusations, the criminal ones, I hope the authorities get involved, as they have now done in the UK. Because whether it's the accused or the accuser, if someone is found to be lying, they need to be held accountable for their actions. But it is time to clean the riffraff out of the wrestling business. And from one horrible story, we come to another. I promise we're going to get everybody in the right headspace after this, because these stories this week are just depressing as shit. But they have to be talked about here. One thing we learned about this week is that WWE, in fact, has never done any actual COVID testing until this week, despite earlier claims of them quote-unquote testing, when, for example, Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone go on Dynamite every week and talk about everybody's been tested. They're at least referring to actual COVID tests that are administered at the beginning of every week that they do a show. So on a Monday, let's say, they'll all be tested. That way they get the results back by Wednesday. And if everybody is clear, they do their show. WWE, they put a thermometer to your head before you can enter the performance center. And if you don't have a fever, and if you tell them that you're not having any other symptoms and you otherwise feel okay, they let you in. That's not testing. If you want to do it that way, that's fine, but that's not really testing. And it's asinine that a billion-dollar company cannot afford testing for talent in the middle of a pandemic when they insist on doing shows. You want to do shows, you have the right to do shows in the state of Florida, then go for it. But the fact that it took them this long to actually have their talent tested is beyond the pale. WWE put a statement out on the person who tested positive at the performance center. Yes, in fact, somebody at the performance center, I guess an NXT talent or trainee, did test positive recently for the virus. They said a developmental talent who was last on site at the training facility on Tuesday, June 9th, has tested positive for COVID. Since that time, no other individuals that attended the facility have reported symptoms. However, out of an abundance of caution and to ensure the health and safety of the company's performers and staff, all talent, production crew, and employees on site at the training and production facilities will be tested for COVID immediately. Following the test results, WWE plans to proceed with its normal television production schedule. This time around, unlike last time, there was no internal memo or text message circulated to the talent to inform everybody, because there had been a previous test. If you recall, there was somebody also at the, or who had been at the PC, this might have been back in March or April, who tested positive. I think it was late March. And everybody was alerted. There was an internal system where everybody at the time was alerted. Not the case this time, according to reports. They learned about it on social media and wrestling news websites, just like the rest of us. And many of them were rightfully upset about that. Per the Observer, the performer who tested positive was a female wrestler in NXT who has not been used on television. She has been one of the fans in the crowd, last used in that role just a few weeks ago. Now, they had plans to tape Monday Night Raw for tomorrow, and SmackDown for this Friday. They were going to tape that this past week. And they were going to tape a whole bunch of stuff. Main Event, 205 Live. Instead, they canceled the tapings, and they had shifted everything over to Wednesday. So the plan was to tape that night's NXT show and the NXT show for the following week on that day as well. It was going to be the longest day of taping in company history, it sounds like. What ended up happening is they taped at the PC, they taped it Full Sail, but they did not get SmackDown in. Things were delayed so much, people were waiting around. They were not able to tape this Friday's SmackDown. So you had the SmackDown crew, who were planning to go home after the taping. They end up staying an extra day, and then the show was never taped. So they're going to be flown back into Orlando this Friday, and they're going to tape SmackDown a few hours before it goes on the air on Fox. But thankfully, it does not appear, at least they have not reported publicly anyway, results-wise, that anyone else tested positive for COVID. So that's great. That's great news. But tied into all this is the fact that WWE started doing something a little bit different this past Monday, and I believe they did it again for the SmackDown show that aired on Friday. But Monday, for sure, they had fans in the crowd. Quote unquote, they had fans. But not really fans. It was friends and family of the performers and the talent and the people who work at the PC. They were invited in to be fans for the taping, mixed in with some of the developmental people. So when you saw some of these faces on TV and they kind of looked like fans, or you didn't really recognize who they were, that's who they were. And in response to questions about fans being in attendance at the PC on Monday, and reports that WWE refused to let fans wear masks at the taping, the company said this: "Fans have not been in attendance at WWE events since March 13. Yesterday, a select number of friends and family were permitted to attend the TV production. These individuals were required to participate in medical screenings prior to entering the closed set at our training facility and were kept apart from in-ring performers and production personnel. Attendance was below 20% capacity and social distancing guidelines were adhered to with at least 6 feet between parties. Thus, face masks were not required." And that sounds all well and good. Except you watch Raw Monday night and you see the Street Profits in the crowd dancing with people in the audience. So they're full of shit. And again, what is the point of keeping the plexiglass if you're just going to have people do shit like that anyway? Then just get rid of it. If you're not going to use it, why even have it in the first place? Brian Alvarez has insisted that people have told him there were no masks to be worn on camera. They were told specifically, you cannot wear masks on camera. He insists that he had multiple people who worked there tell him this, multiple people who were in attendance who told him this, and that per Kevin Dunn, they could wear masks if they wanted to, but if they did, then they were not welcome for the taping. They were not welcome to be on camera. Dunn allegedly said, if you are wearing a mask, you are not a fan. Now, Orange County in Florida, which is where WWE tapes all of these shows now, because COVID cases in the county are going up, COVID cases in the county are on the rise, they are now requiring people to wear masks. The mayor has said every person in the county, I assume this is when you're out in public, must wear a mask. The order went into effect yesterday, Saturday, and the next time WWE tapes television is not going to be, I think, until SmackDown on Friday when they do that live-to-tape show for the Fox show. We'll know. We'll know then if there is an exception made for WWE to that rule. It seems like WWE is an exception to every rule because they're essential. Remember, WWE is essential. They're an essential business. But if Kevin Dunn really did make that statement that if you wear a mask, you are not a fan, then fuck Kevin Dunn. Now, could he have meant if you're wearing a mask, you're not going to be a fan on camera tonight? Not necessarily, oh, you're not a real fan. Sure, maybe that's what he meant, but even still, fuck Kevin Dunn. Fuck Kevin Dunn, fuck Vince McMahon, and anyone else putting their shitty television show over people's safety. And the same goes for any company. Stories like this come out about any company, I would say the same thing. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that they brought in Ric Flair, 71-year-old Ric Flair, with a history of health problems, the same Ric Flair who almost died more than once. They brought him to the Performance Center. He was part of the show Monday night. They brought him there knowing that somebody there had tested positive the week before. This is before everybody else was tested on Wednesday. They had that mass testing of the entire roster. They had Ric Flair in the building. WrestleVotes got a text message in response from somebody at the PC the day they finally did all that mass testing that read as follows. How can I put this nicely? A complete unbelievable lack of leadership. Full-blown clusterfuck. They should be embarrassed. Total clown show. So that is from one person who sent a message to WrestleVotes, which has gotten a lot of stories right in the past. Kevin Owens, he made the decision to not work the company's tapings on Wednesday. He went home. And according to The Observer, it may have had to do with the fact that Owens' wife saw her grandfather about 3 weeks ago die from COVID-19. And he and his family were concerned about him working in a building where somebody had recently tested positive. Now, he could be back as early as this week or next week for the next batch of tapings. Because I think by then it would be, like, enough weeks would have gone by where it would probably be, you know, like, in the clear for him to feel comfortable coming back. But ultimately, that decision is up to him. He elected to go home the first time. If he wants to stay home, like Roman Reigns has decided to stay home, and other people, Sami Zayn, have decided to stay home, then he may make the decision, you know what? I'm going to stay home. That's up to him, and that's his right to do that. And boy, you know, I heard about this story, and I look at this whole situation, and I just, the first person I thought of was Roman Reigns. That's the first person I thought of. And it just goes to show you. Now, Roman Reigns has said, don't assume that it's just because of my health. You know, he has new twins. I'm sure his health factors into things given his history, but he's got young kids. And I said at the time, good on him for making that decision. That could not have been an easy decision for him to make in some ways. In some ways it was, but in other ways it couldn't have been, you know, the easiest decision to make because he is the top star in the company. He is positioned to be the guy. And to take yourself out of the equation, that's not something I think that wrestlers would have done 20 years ago. There would have been this expectation like, we need you. You're the leader. You're the top guy. You got to lead by example. You know what? He is leading by example. Roman Reigns is leading by example. Ultimately, it's up to the performers. If they want to go perform, then go ahead and perform. But, you know, the fact that anybody would hold it against Roman Reigns, I certainly hope that's not the case. And that goes for fans, too. Because if you do, you're a fool. You're a fool. And I'm sure he probably heard about this story, and he knew. He's like, well, there you go. Made the right call there. But this whole situation and the way this whole thing went down is just unbelievable to me. In some ways, maybe not unbelievable, but it really is truly unbelievable. Undertaker, the last ride. He takes his last ride this week. It is the finale of the documentary series that has been excellent, and I would recommend it to anybody who has not given it a watch, even if you're not an Undertaker fan. You don't have to be. It's a very well done series. My video review for Chapter 4, The Battle Within, is up on YouTube if you want to go back and watch it. And the final review, the final recap, is going to hit the YouTube channel on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, like it has been every single week. So I hope you'll join me for it then. One of the cool things about Undertaker doing this documentary and being so open in a way that he never allowed himself to be open before is that he gets to make the media rounds and answer questions about things that we've never heard him speak publicly about. Undertaker was the guest on Corey Graves' After the Bell podcast this week to promote the documentary. And there were a few interesting nuggets coming out of this and some other interviews that Undertaker did this week. He confirmed having a conversation or conversations with Kevin Nash many years ago, probably about 20 years ago now, about making the jump to WCW. He said, as much as I was unhappy with our overall creative and we were struggling and it was getting worse and worse, and yeah, a lot of the guys were calling me, I was talking when Kevin Nash was there, like, man, I'm pretty sure you could get you some pretty big cheese if you want to come down and do this thing. He said something similar on Sam Roberts' podcast. Said, there was a time that I was so frustrated with our creative direction. We had a bunch of really goofy characters. Meanwhile, WCW was down there doing real angles. Now, when he talks about bad creative and goofy characters, that reeks of 1995. Less so than 96 and 97, it reeks of 1995. Nash didn't go to WCW until 96. And as Nash tells the story, because I've told the story before, Nash has done shoot interviews, he's brought this up before about having a conversation with Mark, and almost, you know, so close, he says, to getting him to come in. I don't know how close he was, but those conversations were closer to like 2000, like 99, 2000. Said he almost got him to come in as Biker Taker. So if that's the case, then that would be 2000. He said he wouldn't have come in as the Dead Man. This is Nash now. I'm just telling the Nash story. Nash had said that, yeah, obviously, he wouldn't have come in as the Undertaker because legally they couldn't do that. But he would have been the biker character that he ended up debuting on WWE television. He would have probably just been Mark Calloway, but he would have been dressed, I don't know if he would have rode a motorcycle, but he would have been very much like the character he debuted in 2000. But the bad storylines and the goofy characters, that is totally 1995. He had a horrible match with King Kong Bundy, which I do not blame The Undertaker for, but he had a horrible match with King Kong Bundy at WrestleMania 11. He worked with Mabel, who caved his eye socket in. He did this angle with Kama, who I know he's very good friends with, but that was the story where he melted the urn down into a chain to wear around his neck. The goofy characters were plentiful that year. By 96, though, he was working with Mankind, his greatest rival, in my opinion. Kane is right there. So is Shawn Michaels. But his greatest rival is Mankind. 97, he won the championship. He was working with Brett. He was working with Shawn. They introduced Kane. So I don't know about that timeline that The Undertaker was talking about here. His memory is pretty good with these things, so I wish he would have clarified that a little bit more. But in the end, he said that it was, you know, loyalty. It was loyalty to Vince McMahon and loyalty to the company that kept him where he was. And obviously it paid off in the end. I think he made the right call in hindsight. Undertaker in WCW would have just felt wrong. You know, whatever character he would have portrayed or whatever name he would have used. Maybe they would have gone back to calling him Mean Mark. It just would have felt wrong. Kind of like Sting in WWE. Now, I wish he would have gone sooner and shaved a few years off that TNA run, like about 10, before he got too old. But when WCW was still around and you had the war back and forth with the two companies, Sting and WWE, I don't think that would have felt right either. I feel like the people who were WCW fans and Sting fans would have felt the same way that I feel, and a lot of people feel, about the idea of The Undertaker leaving. It just felt like, how could that be? How could he ever walk away from that character? How could he ever leave? It wouldn't have felt right. You know, Bret Hart did go to WCW, and it never felt right. He never should have gone to WCW. He will tell you, he never should have gone to WCW. He did not want to go to WCW. He made great money in WCW. I don't cry for him in that respect. But clearly, Bret Hart has a lot of regrets, as he should, about his time in WCW. Now imagine if Shawn Michaels had gone there. There's a what-if question for you. That would have been an even bigger disaster. With all the politics being played, all the egos down there, can you imagine Shawn Michaels in the state that he was in back then? 97, 96, 97, going to WCW? I mean, for a while, it probably would have been pretty cool, but I don't see how that would have worked. It would have been a complete disaster. Now, Corey Graves also did some name association. He asked about Yokozuna. Undertaker, he took a long pause, so I couldn't see him on video. I was listening to the audio of it. So I don't know if he was getting choked up or not. I know he and Yoko were very good friends. They worked a lot together. Hey, remember BSK? The Bone Street Crew. Undertaker's even got a BSK tattoo across his stomach. He and Yoko Zuna were part of that little clique. I think they created it. He went to Vince, he says, and personally begged Vince McMahon to let him work with Yokozuna. There was one day Yoko, I guess, was working a dark match, and he was there, and he watched it, and he said, I want to work with this guy, please, let me work with this guy. And as he's talking to Vince McMahon, down the hallway, who should come walking down the hallway but the giant Gonzalez? And Vince McMahon says, oh, you'll work with him, but you're going to work with that guy first. Undertaker turned around and saw, here comes Giant Gonzalez, all 7'7", 7'6", whatever he was. And Undertaker laughed because one of the reasons he left WCW in the first place was because they wanted him to work with Elegante, which is what the Giant Gonzalez was called in WCW. And now, here he is, he says, following me. He's following me from the other company. You're killing me here. And they truly did. Undertaker, I sympathize with him because they truly had horrible matches together. They only had two television matches. I don't know if they worked on house shows or anything. But, you know, WrestleMania 9 and the whole chloroform finish and then the Rest in Peace match at SummerSlam back in 93. They were horrible. And I don't blame Undertaker for that at all. Mark Calloway is not a miracle worker. He might be an Undertaker, but he's not a miracle worker. What could he do? What could he do with Giant Gonzalez? Nothing. There was nothing that he could do. On the greatest wrestling match ever, between Edge and Randy Orton at Backlash, Undertaker told Corey Graves that the match almost brought a tear to his eye. What a story they told. He said that he sent a text message to Edge, telling him the next time that he visits the PC to work with some of the guys down there, he's going to pull that tape up and show it to them and dissect it, all the little things about it that they did. He talked about how athletic the current talent roster is, but it means very little, he says, when all you rely on is your athleticism. He says eventually fans get desensitized to the double backflip off the top rope onto somebody on the floor. You push the envelope and that brings a higher risk for injury. He said that the match between Edge and Randy Orton needs to be studied even by the main roster talent. And it's everything professional wrestling is supposed to be. Now look, he's not wrong about the point about relying on just your athleticism. You need good stories. I mean, you need to, we talked about this before, right? We hear wrestlers talk about it all the time as fans when we watch the show. Everybody has different tastes for what they watch wrestling for, but you know, it's not enough to just be a good wrestler or have flashy moves, right? You probably want the person ideally to be able to talk. That would be nice. You want good stories, which is not always in the control of the talent. The company has to work with the talent. The company has to either come up with the stories or okay story ideas. And some of these stories are not always the greatest, and it could actually hurt the talent and not help the talent. But you need good stories to get you to those big matches. I don't think he's saying anything earth-shattering here, but I could see those comments shattering some fragile egos behind the scenes. I don't think he was being dismissive of the current roster, but he was offering some valid criticism of wrestling today in general. Here's something else I agree with him on. From an interview that he did with comicbook.com, he was asked if he thinks wrestlers should go back to protecting their characters like he did. Or is that just not possible at this point? He said, I've had this conversation a lot with Vince McMahon, with Shawn Michaels, and with Triple H. He says, I can't remember who. I think it might have been Triple H used the analogy, it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. That being said, I do think that the reins should be pulled back a little bit. I think due to the amount of, number one, the amount of content, and the couple that with the amount of social media that our talent does. It is just hard for me to see guys on TV trying to be one thing, and then they're on their personal social media pages and they're something completely different. It is such a huge disconnect for me. Obviously, I'm not saying that the way I did things was absolutely the right way to do it. It was the right way for me to do it. And I think that's a good point. The kind of character The Undertaker had, you can totally understand why he would have been so protective and wanting to keep kayfabe and not be seen out of character. And because that was such a unique character. You wanted people to actually be afraid of The Undertaker, little kids to be afraid of The Undertaker, people to buy into the darker aspects of the character. You know, if you were walking down the street in 1994 and you saw Mark Calloway walking down with, you know, wearing some kind of smiley face t-shirt with a fucking pink bow in his hair, all of a sudden you're not so afraid of The Undertaker anymore. So he felt that he had to live the gimmick. He had to live the character. That may not be the case with everybody. The way that Undertaker treated his character might be different than the way Ricochet. You know, Ricochet might do things a little bit different than The Undertaker did. Anyway, he continued. He said, but I think there's more of a, and this is just my thoughts, he said, but there's more of an emphasis on the talents putting on their social media, what they're putting on their social media, than what they are putting into their characters and doing on TV. And I think that's a big disconnect with the audience. I think that they should pump the brakes a little bit on the outside stuff and figure out what it is that they are and what they're going to do on TV, because really, that's what people are watching. It is such a weird world now that everybody wants to know everything that's going on behind the scenes, and that's great, but just because they want it doesn't mean they necessarily need to get it. They don't need to get everything. There needs to be some sense of mystery, some mystique. Again, I think he's bang on. We know too much. I think we could all admit that. We know too much. And it's not just newsletters and websites. Newsletters and wrestling news websites have been around for a few decades now. You know, the earliest wrestling news websites go back to the mid-90s. The newsletters go back to at least the early 80s. That's been around. But wrestlers being as accessible as they are, you know, posting photos, like, it's social media. That's really what it boils down to. That was the game changer here. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and YouTube. Yeah, you can put YouTube in there. But like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and platforms like that, that changed the whole ballgame. In some ways for the better, in a lot of ways for the worse. Especially with Twitter. Wrestlers now, they're completely accessible. Posting photos out of character, answering questions, they've pulled the curtain back. Even guys who never would have been caught dead on social media, like The Undertaker. Caught dead, no pun intended. But now The Undertaker, who's mostly retired anyway, he's on Twitter and he's on Instagram. And, you know, Dean Ambrose, for years, remember the first tweet he ever posted? They forced me to set this up and then he never used it. And I kind of like that, the fact that he would not be on social media. Well, now Jon Moxley, he's actually on social media quite a bit. And again, I kind of like it, but I also respected the fact that for so long he resisted. They made him set one up and he never used it. And you know what? There was a sense of mystery around the guy. What's he like outside the ring? He seems like a crazy person. You would hear stories from his wife. But rarely would you see Moxley posting on social media. But we're seeing more and more people get who would not have done this before now getting involved on social media. And it does kill some of the mystique. Absolutely. Without question. The problem is you can't unring that bell. Or as he says, put the toothpaste back into the tube. I like that analogy as well. By the way, have you ever put toothpaste back into the tube? The answer is no, you haven't, because it's not possible. Believe me, I've tried. It's not possible. But I do think it has killed a lot of the mystique. I'm also not 8 years old anymore. Let's just be honest here. I don't know how many of you became fans as a kid. Some of you may have become big wrestling fans when you were a teenager. Maybe you're only a new fan to the business, and you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s. Not everybody is a kid when they first become a wrestling fan. I was 5 years old. That's when my fandom dates back to. But I'm not 5 years old. I'm not 8 years old. I'm not 12 years old anymore. The older you get, naturally, the more inquisitive that you get about the goings-on behind the scenes and wanting to learn more about the personas on TV. Now you have reality shows that take you behind the scenes. Total Divas, Total Bellas. Tough Enough. Tough Enough goes back to 2000, where they were pulling back the curtain and showing you things that you would never have seen previously. But it's funny, like, imagine if a lot of those guys from the 80s and the 90s were on Twitter back then, right? Imagine Macho Man Randy Savage on Twitter. Undertaker back then on Twitter. The Freebirds on Twitter. The Horsemen on Twitter. Some things are better left to the imagination. Speaking of things being left to the imagination, that is the perfect segue that I did not plan. He was asked the million-dollar question in this interview on comicbook.com, not by Corey Graves. What do you say to the fans who, to this day, still hold out hope for a match between you and Sting? This is what The Undertaker had to say. He says, in this world, you never say never. Spoken like a true wrestler. You never say never, but I think as great as it sounds on paper, and it does, I mean, obviously that's a super marquee match, right? But where I kind of differ from a lot of people is I look past the marquee value and I look at the ability to deliver. So like you said, there's so many people who are clamoring for that match that I just don't know the match would deliver on people's expectations. And the only reason I say that, he says, I take full responsibility. I don't have the mobility or the same skill set I once did that I need to make that match great. It's better left to the theater of the mind to actually put it out there. And then with the expectations being so high and the match not delivering, it would be a bigger disappointment than the match never happening at all. 10 years ago, I think it still could have happened and it could have been a stellar match. I'm just not sure at this point that it could ever deliver on the hype. And then he was asked, I know there were rumors of the match floating around WrestleMania 27. Has there ever been a time where it was seriously considered or discussed? He said, not to my knowledge. I know the temperature got turned up on that, and I don't remember which Mania it was, but Sting and I were on the same flight after a WrestleMania, and that, by the way, was after WrestleMania 31. After Raw that Monday, the Raw after WrestleMania, they were photographed together, chatting briefly at the airport, so that's what he's talking about. He said, we were standing in line together and talking, and somebody, obviously, in this day and age, everybody has a camera, and somebody snapped a picture as we were just having a casual conversation. No one ever approached me with anything serious, like, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about working with Sting? Or it's never been presented to me by anyone other than our fans. So there it is. That is The Undertaker's claim as to why the match with Sting never happened. A, he was never approached about the idea anyway, but B, at this stage, or in the last few years, he feels physically he just would not be able to keep up the way that he would want to keep up. And I think he's got too much respect to say something like that about Sting, but the reality is Sting is even older than The Undertaker. Sting is older by about 5 or 6 years. Sting's already in his 60s. Now back then, WrestleMania 27, what was that, 2011? He wasn't. You know, he would have been early 50s. But Sting is older, and look, Sting is a little slower, and he's not the Sting that he used to be either. And Undertaker has too much respect to say that, but it goes both ways. You know, it's not just The Undertaker who isn't what he once was. You could say the same thing about Sting, and so I've always wondered if he was concerned about that as well. Not just himself, but in his mind, feeling, if I'm going to go in there and do something, unless it's just something fun, like with my friends, like what they did in Saudi Arabia, him and Kane against Shawn and Triple H, and what a fucking disaster that was, unless it's something like that, that he just thinks would be fun, I could see him wanting to, you know, do a match with somebody who's younger and faster and who can bump around and really carry the load and make that thing as good as it can possibly be and work around his limitations. Sting does not qualify. Sting does not qualify as a more spry, faster, younger talent who's going to go in there and that he can, in his mind, say, okay, I trust that this guy is going to help me, you know, along here and we're not going to end up looking like fools. I just think he doesn't want to say that. But it boils down to him just feeling they couldn't live up to the hype. And the reality is, he's right. He's right. The only way at this point that you could do Sting and The Undertaker, and even something like a cinematic match, if Sting is not medically cleared, I don't know that he would even be allowed to do that. He'd still have to take bumps. I mean, you know, he's got to do something. But if he could get cleared for a cinematic style match, similar to the Boneyard match that he did with AJ at WrestleMania, that I think at this stage, if you wanted to do it, it absolutely would have to be a cinematic style match or a fight scene, really is what that was. It wasn't a match. It was a fight scene. A Sting Undertaker fight scene like what he did with AJ at WrestleMania, I think could be tremendous. I think that absolutely could work. In the ring, absolutely not. Undertaker is 100% right. That ship sailed long ago when they did not do the match at WrestleMania 31. That was their shot. They didn't take it, and that was it. They missed their mark. They missed their mark. But cinematically, I still think if they wanted to do that, that would be a workable scenario. But anyway, Chapter 5 is out now on the network. Again, I'm going to be watching it as soon as I'm done here. And I hope you'll join me for my review on the channel Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Mike Chioda joined Chris Jericho for his first ever podcast interview on Talk is Jericho this past week. Jericho was in the one and only match that Chioda ever wrestled in as a wrestler, which was back during the invasion period. It was Jericho, The Rock, and Mike Chioda against the Dudley Boys and referee Nick Patrick. Bubba Ray stiffed him on a clothesline, but he got to deliver a people's elbow to Nick Patrick to pick up the win for his team. October 4th, 2001 episode of SmackDown, for those who want to go back and watch it. He spent 35 years working for WWE, 31 of those as a referee. He started out on the ring crew and worked his way up. Andre the Giant would ask him to go buy him liquor and French wine, but he was underage. So he would wait outside the liquor store for somebody to either come out or to go in. He would give them Andre's money and tell them what he was looking for. It was a very particular type of like French wine, and buy it for him. He's lucky these people never took the money and ran. I wouldn't want to be the one to go back and tell Andre. But he's been part of some of the biggest matches in the history of that company, from 1-2-3 Kids Upset on Raw of Razor Ramon back in 93, Stone Cold and Shawn Michaels in the main event of WrestleMania 14, after Earl Hebner had a brain aneurysm. That's the only reason Earl wasn't the referee for that match, and Chioda got the spot. And thankfully, Earl recovered, and he came back, and all was well. Hulk Hogan and The Rock, WrestleMania 18. I would give Vince Russo's right arm to be in the ring during that match on that night, when Hogan kicked out from the Rock bottom and he hulked up. Even just to be in the crowd, let alone in the ring. Rock's comeback match against John Cena in Miami at WrestleMania 28. The biggest WrestleMania buy rate of all time. Chioda was the referee for all of them. And then in April, he was unceremoniously released. He was fired. Without even so much as an explanation or a reason given why. He says it took him by complete surprise. He was kind of ambushed by the whole thing. Did not see it coming. He had surgery in October for a torn rotator cuff and a torn bicep. He was all healed up. He was ready to come back even at WrestleMania this year. He was all physically ready to go. All healed up, and he had even signed a brand new contract in March before WrestleMania with a bump in pay. And then on April 15th, he got a phone call telling him that he was fired. He didn't say who called him, but it wasn't Vince McMahon. It wasn't Stephanie McMahon. I mean, I wouldn't think it would be. They don't do that type of grunt work. That was always the job that went to people like Jim Ross and Johnny Ace. Let them be the hatchet man, you know, or J.J. Dillon back in the day. Let them be the bad guy. Let them be the bad guy. I assume this time it was Mark Carano. Carano's the head of talent relations in the company, who called him, but he didn't say. But in this case, I don't know. I mean, you would just think that somebody who has given that many years of service, one of the longest tenured workers in your company, would at least be given a reason why. Especially after having just signed a new deal. The only time I can remember Chioda's name being mentioned publicly for any kind of issue or anything negative was back in 2011. I remember that because he was the last name I ever would have expected to be mentioned as part of something like this, but he was suspended for his first violation of the talent wellness policy. I don't know what he was suspended for. I don't believe he was suspended again after that. But that's the only time I've ever heard his name mentioned sideways in any kind of, publicly in any kind of way. But anyway, he said he doesn't know if he had heat with somebody or why he would have heat with somebody, given that he was off the road for 6 months healing up from an injury. It sounded like he was really just grasping at straws when he was talking about the heat stuff. I don't know that he had heat. I mean, I'm not backstage, so I can't say for sure that he didn't. But I don't want, people might hear that and think, oh, he had heat. Where did he have heat from? It sounded to me like he was just trying to come up with an explanation of why this happened. I think it was just a victim of cost cutting, plain and simple, right? They have a group of younger referees now that together, those two things couple, right? Cost cuts, and they have younger referees who I'm sure are not getting paid what Mike Chioda is being paid. That little bump in pay that he says he got in March, that might have been what did him in. I think it probably just boils down to that more than anything else. But he says his career is not over. He hopes to land somewhere once the pandemic stuff starts to die down a little bit. It's a good listen. He doesn't break any major ground, but there were two things. He explained why Vince McMahon suddenly banned the referees from being mentioned by name on television a few years ago. And it is a very Vince McMahon type of story. He says, I didn't get that. I believe they were saying my name too much and the referees' names too much, but it wasn't with me. It was with another referee that he did not recognize their name. And one day he was like, I guess he was looking at a run sheet or something, and he's like, who is this? Who is this person? And somebody said, oh, it's the referee. And he goes, well, God damn it, I'm done hearing this referee's name. I don't want to hear the referee's names no more. And that was it. That was it. I guess he felt they were putting the referee's names over too much. He didn't know the name, and so he's like, that's it, no more referee names. Now, since then, that obviously has changed because they have acknowledged referees on screen. But yeah, for a while there, I would say even for a few years, they just stopped naming the referees. They were just random people in striped shirts on TV. All because Vince McMahon did not recognize the name of one of the referees. And so everybody got banned. Seems rational to me. He also talked about Joey Morella, which was very cool. So for some background, Gorilla Monsoon is the one who hired Chioda in the first place to come work on the ring crew. Before he became a referee, Gorilla was the one who got him his gig. And he became very good friends with Gorilla's son, Joey, who worked for the company as a referee. Joey Morella was the referee for some huge matches. I mean, two of the most famous matches of all time. Hogan Andre at WrestleMania 3 and Bret Hart against the British Bulldog at Wembley Stadium at SummerSlam back in 92. Joey was the referee for both of those matches. And Joey helped Chioda in his transition to becoming a referee. So Chioda talked about all of the things that he and Joey had in common. How, you know, they were very good friends. They both liked to fish. They both liked baseball. They both liked hockey. And they would hang out even outside the ring. You know, they'd take a day or two. They would hang out together before they had to go back out on the road. When Joey died, they had been on the road for 17 straight days. And they were running a show in Maryland. That was the taping where Bret Hart beat Bob Backlund. It was a Superstars taping. And after the match was over, Bob just snapped, slapped Bret in the face, put him in the chicken wing, and we saw that it was really the debut of Crazy Bob. Bob Backlund's heel character was that night. And Joey worked that show. He worked that taping, and that would be his last. He wanted to go visit his mother in New Jersey. Now, Chioda and Tony Chimmel, who were traveling together, they told him, they said, hey, come with us. You know, ride with us. Stay with us. We'll go to the Jersey Shore the next morning. Hang out. Because they were finally coming off the road for a few days, and they were like, hey, we could all hang out together. But he said, he wanted to visit his mother, and, you know, so it's very late at night now. The taping is over. Again, 17 straight days on the road. Just saying that sounds exhausting. I'm sure all of them were just, completely shot at that point. But he's driving with Harvey Whippleman. Harvey Whippleman is in the car with him. Joey is driving. Harvey had his seatbelt on. Joey did not. And Joey dozed off behind the wheel, which is not hard to imagine, given how long, how long those tapings were, 17 straight days on the road, which was commonplace. That kind of thing was commonplace back then. He fell asleep at the wheel, and they got into a single car accident on the New Jersey Turnpike, right by the exit where his mother lived. Whippleman survived. I mean, he was hurt pretty badly, but he was wearing his seatbelt. He survived. Joey did not. Chioda said that he and Schimmel drove past the accident that night. They had no idea at the time that it was Joey. Schimmel said to Chioda, hey, take a look at this. There were cop cars everywhere, fire trucks, probably ambulances. You know, when you see a major accident on the highway, I mean, we've all seen horrible traffic accidents. Everybody slows down and rubbernecks. They have to look over and see what's going on. And they did the same thing. They kind of slowed down. They're looking over. But they did not know that Joey or Bruno, Harvey Whippleman, were involved in the accident. And it wasn't until 6:30 the following morning that he found out Joey had died in that accident. And it was Gorilla Monsoon who called to tell him. Imagine that phone call. God. Gorilla was the one. He just lost his son. But he probably knew how friendly they were, and he was the one to call Chioda and give him the news. That's awful. That's awful. A lot of people have said, you know, Monsoon was never the same after Joey died. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of parents would feel the same way after losing a child. It's a horrible thing. But Chioda said he would like to see Joey one day honored in the Hall of Fame. I don't know if Joey Morello is honored in other wrestling halls of fame. He doesn't have to be honored in the, I mean, this goes to the whole thing about the WWE Hall of Fame. And, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, deserve to have their day in the sun and be honored and all that. But I don't get bent out of shape anymore about the WWE Hall of Fame because the whole thing is just a joke. But he would like to see Joey acknowledged in some way. He would like to see Joey Morello become maybe the first referee even to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame, because right now there are none. And Chioda said he's not sure that we'll ever see a day where a referee is inducted into their Hall of Fame. So I would say if they were going to do it, Chioda is one who also definitely deserves to be recognized. And you could add to that list Tommy Young and Earl Hebner, who was actually trained by Tommy Young, since we're talking about referees being inducted into the Hall of Fame, which they should be. They should be. The importance of the wrestling referee does not get enough attention. I don't think referees get enough credit. I really don't. And that was part of what he talked about in this interview, which was fascinating to hear somebody with his experience talk about it, that you've got three people in a singles match. You've got three people in that ring. It's the two wrestlers and the referee plays a vital role in keeping things together, feeding cues and information from one wrestler to the other, or from the back to the wrestlers. Sometimes they'll take bumps. They have to be positioned in the right place. Sometimes they factor into the finish of a match. These are all very important things that I think people just take for granted. I'm the same way. Look, I used to play, when I was younger, I used to play those old WWF video games like Royal Rumble and Raw. And I would take great pleasure in punching the referee in the head and knocking him down. I had no respect for authority back then. Don't be like me. Respect the referee. Long Island's Nassau Coliseum, which I've been going to for wrestling shows as far back as I can remember, and has hosted some big WWE events over the past few decades, has been shut down indefinitely. The closure is being blamed on COVID, but the reality is the arena was already $100 million in debt. So I guess you could say it was already sick and on life support, and COVID just came along and pulled the plug on the machine. The virus and the lack of revenue from no events, that really is what seems to have dealt the potentially fatal blow. We don't know yet for sure. According to a story on Bloomberg.com, the Russian billionaire that operates the venue under a lease from Nassau County is shutting it down While he is seeking investors to take over operations, he's seeking investors to assume the remaining $100 million debt on the building. He could also end up surrendering the lease to its lenders. This all remains to be seen. But here's the quote. The unforeseeable and unprecedented COVID crisis has had a devastating effect on the operations of the Coliseum and its finances. While we still believe in the enormous long-term economic value of the Coliseum and the development of the surrounding land, we recognize such value will be best realized by other parties. So there is always the chance that, you know, they could end up finding some other investor and it can be resuscitated in the next few years. But there's also the chance that this could be the end for the Nassau Coliseum. It is not the first time that the Coliseum has been closed. About 5 years ago, it closed for about 2 years. That was for renovations. They pumped almost $200 million worth of renovations into that building. And now you look at it from the, you can look it up on the arena website even. The exterior now of the building, it looks like a giant slinky. It didn't always look like that. It only looks like that because of the renovations they did. I guess that's the more modern look that they're going for. It does. It looks like a giant slinky. I would have to think with all the money they pumped into those renovations that it will reopen at some point. But you never know. You know, if they are trying to redevelop the area around the Coliseum with the hopes that that will bring more traffic to the building. But if that redevelopment project, which is on hold right now, if that falls through, it could spell doom for the Nassau Coliseum. Now, Nassau was never known. And you've heard me talk about this before, and I know because I've been to this building. Nassau Coliseum is not known for the greatest crowd reactions. Now, it's not as bad as Corpus Christi, but it's not much better. And one of the more famous moments in that building, and I happened to be in the building that night for it, I was at that Raw where he did this, was when Paul Heyman, who was nearing the end of his run as a commentator on Raw, this was only a few weeks before he got bounced out of the announce position and Jerry Lawler came back to the company. It was in November of 2001, during one of the commercial breaks. This did not air on TV. This happened during a commercial break when they were dark in the building. Well, not dark. I mean, the lights were on, but they were not on TV. And in the middle of the show, Paul Heyman stands up from the announce desk. He does this on his own. To the best of my knowledge, he was not told to do this. He did this on his own. I guess as a New Yorker, a native New Yorker, he was very upset by the lack of crowd reaction on this show. He gets up. He grabs the house mic. He walks halfway up the ring steps and then looks out into the crowd. He looks out at all of us. He actually looked out right like on the side of the building that I was on. The stage and the ramp and everything was to my left. He looked out at our side of the building and he said, "This crowd is the worst audience that we have ever performed in front of." And I'm paraphrasing here, but he made another comment about how they should never, ever tape another television show here ever again. And he got great heat for it, you know, and I get that he was a heel at the time, although he wasn't a manager. I mean, he wasn't really an in-ring performer, but he meant what he said. This was not just to get heat, like as a heel. He meant what he said, and the people were not happy about that. And I will say, from what I can remember, the crowd that night was pretty bad. It was an Nassau crowd. It was an Nassau crowd. I'd have to go back and take a look. I think that was the night that Rock beat Chris Jericho in the main event to win the WCW title. I don't remember much about the rest of the show. I don't know if it was a bad show or not. But anyway, it can be like pulling teeth in that building sometimes to get a reaction. But I can't ever remember a situation like that before, where the announcer, in the middle of the show, gets on the mic and just completely shits on the audience the way that Paul Heyman did that night. But, I mean, my earliest memory from Nassau Coliseum, I mean, I was going to shows in Jersey, you know, at the Meadowlands and Madison Square Garden going back to, you know, 1987 was probably the first show I ever went to. But my earliest memory from Nassau was a show, and I looked it up. I knew that there was an Ultimate Warrior Papa Shango match. And I knew some of the matches on the card, and I was able to figure out which one it was. It was May 1st, 1992. I was at that show. It was a live event at Nassau Coliseum. We got the Ultimate Warrior against Papa Shango. And we got Bret Hart defending the Intercontinental Championship against Shawn Michaels. So that was my first Bret Hart-Shawn Michaels match. And the main event of the show was not the Ultimate Warrior, actually. The main event of the show was LOD beating the Beverly Brothers. I do have vague memories of this. The rest of the card I have no memory of. But that's how far back I can remember going as far as Nassau. I can remember winning tickets. I won tickets. I mean, I still don't know how I did this. I won tickets 8 different times from the local radio station here in New York between 1998 and 1999. 8 times. And this was one of those things where you had to call in and get it just right. Like, you didn't have to call in and be the first caller or be, you know, answer a trivia question. I think pretty much most or all of them was you had to be caller 95 because it was 95.5 WPLJ at the time. And then a few months ago, I think the station went out. It got taken over. Now it's like a Christian radio station or something. But that was one of the big radio stations in New York at the time. And you'd have to be caller 95 or caller 28 or something. And I had a system. We had 2 phones in the apartment, 2 landline phones. And for some of them, I did it on my own. For others, I told my brother, I said, hey, come here. I said, you're going to go on the other phone. Go on the other line. I'm going to go on this one. We're both going to call at the same time. If you get through, you hand the phone to me. And then we would go to work. And I managed to get through 8 different times. First, it was Raw. A few months later, it was Raw at the Nassau Coliseum. It was like my little belated birthday gift to myself in October of 98. And that was a big show because that was the night that Steve Austin poured cement, or as Jim Ross said, cement, in Vince McMahon's Corvette. That was the night that the Blue Blazer returned for the first time in a decade. And we all know how that turned out. But that night at Nassau was the Blue Blazer's first appearance since, whatever, 1988, 1989. And it was also the return of the Big Boss Man to the company as one of Vince McMahon's henchmen. At the end of the show, he was dressed up like a member of the Shield. Big Boss Man was the original member of the Shield. He's the founding father of the Shield. I have a lot of memories, though. I do have a lot of memories of being there. There are other events that have taken place at Nassau Coliseum that maybe aren't so wonderful. For example, Vince Russo won the WCW Championship from Booker T on Nitro in a cage match at the Nassau Coliseum, which for Russo, I'm sure, was a big deal because he's a New Yorker and he got to win the championship in New York. But that's a memory I'd rather forget. Draz, he wrestled his final match at the Nassau Coliseum. That was the night that he was paralyzed in the match with D'Lo Brown. Thankfully, I was not there to see that. One of the greatest SummerSlams of all time, SummerSlam 2002, is at Nassau Coliseum. The final WWE branded, or it might have been how many of them did they even do? I don't remember how many Great American Bash shows WWE did. They probably did about 4 or 5 of them, I'm guessing. But the final Great American Bash that they ever did was at Nassau Coliseum in 2008. Then it just became The Bash. It was no longer the Great American Bash. Now it's just The Bash. Fatal 4-Way, the one and only Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view they ever did. I was there for that. I wish I wasn't. And Evolution, the one and only women's only pay-per-view they did a couple of years ago, which was actually, I thought, an excellent show, was at the Nassau Coliseum. So, anyway, those are some of my memories. I thought, you know, lighten the mood a little bit and talk a little bit about that. Hopefully, we'll find a way to have a resurgence, but it's not looking too good. It's not looking too good for the Nassau Coliseum. Now, what I want to do here is I realize we're very deep into the show. I don't want to go into a lot of detail because I'm exhausted from all this other stuff. But I do want to talk a little bit about Raw and SmackDown and then a little bit about AEW and NXT. And then we're going to call it a day because there's a lot to take in this week. You know, and I actually enjoy those weeks where we have like big stories to really... That's really what I founded the Sound Off on. The Sound Off was never founded to be a review show. It just sort of morphed into that and a bunch of other things. But you go back and listen to a lot of those early episodes and you'll see, you know, the big stories. Unfortunately, the stories to cover this week were, they were what they were. I hate having to talk about stuff like that. But, you know, you have to address it. You know, you have to address it. And these are stories that people are talking about. And so anyway, that's how I want to just kind of end on here. But I do want to go back. I did have a few thoughts on Monday Night Raw, which was a very dialogue heavy show. Not so much heavy on the in-ring action at all, but more story driven, dialogue driven. It was a show where they brought back Christian, The Big Show, and Ric Flair. So naturally the ratings did rise a little bit. I think they were still under 2 million, but they did go up. It was a better show than it has been in recent weeks. It was carried by the show-long angle involving Randy Orton and Christian, which is always a smart move to do what they did on Monday, where you have a story like this, which is, you know, a pretty heavy story. After what Orton did to Edge, he punted him in the head, Edge is injured, now he's gone, here comes Edge's best friend. Yeah, it was a personal issue, and they teased you into believing that there would be a match later on in the night between Christian, who has not wrestled the match in many, many years. But here he was coming back to avenge his friend, and he was going to wrestle Randy Orton, a man that he himself has a very long history with. Think back to their rivalry in 2011 and some of those tremendous matches they had for the World Heavyweight Championship. There was a history there between Christian and Randy Orton. And I like the way they threaded this story throughout the show. We had different segments throughout the night. He was getting a pep talk in the back from The Big Show. He was getting a pep talk in the back, don't do this, don't go out there, by Ric Flair, who ended up giving him a low blow. Once Christian finally did come out, they were having their quote-unquote match, and Ric Flair came out and he gave Christian a low blow. He's Randy all the way. And then Orton did his thigh slap as he punted Christian in the head and pinned him and beat him. Christian is not actually medically clear. I thought maybe they had secretly cleared him as well, and they were building to an Extreme Rules match where Orton would wrestle Christian. That is not the case. Apparently, Christian is not medically cleared. He had the concussion history. They never mentioned the word concussion on TV. Only that Christian is not cleared. He's had a medical history. And that apparently has not changed. This was just an angle to do on the show. It looks like they wrote him off with that punt kick at the end. But I thought it was smart. The way they did this and the heat they put on Randy Orton for what they did. The only thing, and I say this about a lot of these angles they do, is that it's too bad they couldn't do this in front of an actual audience of 10,000 people, because the heat that Orton would have gotten for this probably would have been off the charts. Seth Rollins, you know, his speeches are getting quite boring, I think, but he was teasing Rey Mysterio, who was there again via satellite. Rey is going to be back in the flesh live on TV tomorrow night, but he was teasing Rey Mysterio that, you know, he might, his son might join up with him. His son Dominic might join his little faction, and if he doesn't, then his son might have to be sacrificed. Hopefully not Undertaker sacrificed, like Ministry Undertaker 1999 sacrificed, like he sacrificed Midian and people like that, but he said that Dominic would have to be sacrificed if he was not willing to join him. And out comes Dominic, who of course is training at the PC, training to become a wrestler, and he attacked Rollins from behind. He evaded capture when Murphy tried to grab him and Austin Theory tried to grab him. He outran them. He dove into the audience and ran off. I like that. I like the stuff with Dominic and all that. I liked. Rey is going to be on TV tomorrow night to further the storyline. So that part of it I liked. Lashley has officially told Lana he wants a divorce. As I predicted, I said it at Backlash, the best possible outcome. Drew McIntyre retains, Bobby Lashley loses, but he still looks strong. It was Lana who caused the distraction and led to the loss, and out of this, we get the divorce. We get the divorce and the conclusion of that shitty storyline with Bobby Lashley and Lana. Everybody wins. Except Lana, I guess, but everybody wins. Speaking of Lana, though, the Iconics beat the makeshift team of Natalya and Liv Morgan. Later on in the bag, Natty was very upset. She was upset with Liv. She was blaming her and her rookie mistakes for the loss. Now, mind you, when this was going on, nobody was there except the cameraman. It wasn't like Liv Morgan was there. It was just Natalya venting to all of us on TV. And all of a sudden, out from the shadows behind her, from where, like, the equipment boxes are, there's Lana. Lana was there the whole time, apparently. She was still shell-shocked by her Bobby demanding a divorce. She said that she felt Natty's pain. The two of them shared a moment. They kind of bonded in that moment together, understanding each other's pain. I don't know if this is leading to a new tag team with them, and the idea of Lana again in the ring as a wrestler terrifies me. But I like the segment, though. Again, this was a story. This was a show that had more storytelling aspects to it. And so this was a segment that I think, at least, if it does lead to something, at least we had the backstory here, right? Two women who were down on their luck, down in the dumps, both dealing with their own kind of pain, coming together, being brought together, not being brought together randomly like we see so many times on this show. And that's really all I have to say about the show for Monday. You know, the Orton Christian stuff was the big thing. Mustafa Ali has reportedly, very quietly, I don't know if he's been moved on the WWE.com roster page yet, but it is being said that he has been quietly moved. He has been quietly relocated from the SmackDown brand to the Raw brand. And it looks like the hacker storyline, the SmackDown hacker storyline, might also have been quietly dropped because there has been no mention of it in weeks. There have been no new videos from the hacker in weeks. Mustafa Ali was rumored to be the hacker. Now he's been moved to a different show. I guess maybe the hacker could show up on Raw, but, you know, for them to start and stop that storyline would be kind of dumb. But I guess they've done it before, right? GTV. We never got a resolution with GTV either. So we may see the hacker storyline go in the dustbin of storylines with GTV and the white Hummer and WCW and all these angles that never really had a resolution. But Mustafa Ali, whether it's Raw or SmackDown, he needs to be back on TV. Mustafa Ali is too talented to be sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. He's not hurt. He's ready to go. He's even vented on social media about this. Let's get this guy back on TV. Whether it's Raw or SmackDown, he could be an essential part of the roster. He's a talented guy. So hopefully he can get some TV time for himself. If he's not going to get it on Fridays, hopefully he can start getting some on Mondays. Now, Raw tomorrow night, they've already announced Charlotte is going to be challenging Asuka for the Raw Women's Championship. And so it begins. We've got the Street Profits defending the tag team titles against the Viking Raiders. We've been told that before. I'll believe it when I see it. And Sasha Banks and Bayley are going to, I believe, defend their tag team titles against the Iconics. So that is what has been announced for Raw. Now, SmackDown on Friday night opened. It had an AJ Styles celebration. He is the new Intercontinental Champion. Wrestlers surrounding the ring. He wanted Daniel Bryan to come in and strap the belt around his waist. Daniel Bryan, when he was in the ring, he talked about hoping that AJ Styles is a fighting champion, like he would have been. And he was pointing at certain people around the ring. And one of the people he pointed at was Drew Gulak. And I just talked about this last week, right? One of the things I loved about Styles winning the championship is the fact that Gulak beat him on TV the week before. So now that AJ is the champion, Drew Gulak has a claim to being the number one contender because he pinned the champion. And Brian pointed out the same thing. AJ refused. He didn't want to have anything to do with him. But AJ, or Brian rather, pointed at Big E. He pointed at Big E outside the ring and said, I'd like to see you challenge Big E and defend Big E or defend the championship against Big E. And I agree with that so much. I think there's a lot of potential there in a singles run for Big E. I think the New Day stuff is played out. But their tag team division on SmackDown, if you take New Day away and the Usos are already hurt and the Forgotten Sons of Anarchy are pretty much on ice, they've been benched. They've been replaced. Their spot has been taken by Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura, who attacked New Day after their match with the Lucha House Party. They can't afford to get rid of the New Day right now as an act or split them up or not even split them up, but maybe have Big E start doing single stuff because the tag team division would be in complete shambles if they did that. You've also got Heavy Machinery on the brand, but it's not a strong tag team division that they have. But I would like to see Big E start to get some singles opportunities as well. He looked over at Grand Metalik. He said, why don't you defend against Grand Metalik? Great idea. I think that would be fantastic. I think AJ Styles and Grand Metalik could have a hell of a match together. Those are the things that I would like to see during AJ Styles' run as the Intercontinental Champion. And it began on the show Friday night because out comes Matt Riddle. Now, Matt Riddle has his own issues to deal with right now. This was taped before the allegations. All that is still pending as far as how that's going to shake out. But out comes Matt Riddle for his big main roster debut. He's in the ring cutting a promo on AJ Styles. He's the, you know, you're the face that runs the place. He goes, I'm the bro that runs the show. They were already making reference to him not wearing any shoes. It's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time. But this led to a match, a non-title match, AJ Styles against Matt Riddle. They gave this match away on night one, which I think was maybe not the wisest thing to do, but having watched the match and the fact that they put Riddle over here, you can't deny the fact that this was huge for Matt Riddle, and this established him on night one as a key player on this SmackDown brand. And on top of that, I thought they had a pretty damn good match. I'd like to see more of it. So now that's two people that have pinfall wins on TV over the champion that could lay claim to wanting to get or deserve a shot at the championship. Drew Gulak and Matt Riddle. Maybe you have the two of them face off and the winner gets the next shot. Gulak was hugging Riddle when it was over. I mean, they probably go back to the, you know, the Evolve days. I don't know offhand if they've worked together. They probably have. I don't think I've ever seen, if they have though, I don't think I've you know, seen any of their matches. But Styles was going for the phenomenal forearm. Riddle caught him, hit the bro Derek, and got the pin. So they're holding this guy up. They're hoisting him up. You would think he's the new crown prince of SmackDown. Now, unfortunately, there was also a little bit of an interaction with him and Baron Corbin. So I think we all know where this could very easily be going. But look, I'm okay with him kind of having some other storyline before he gets involved in the title picture. It does feel too soon. It does feel too soon. We've been seeing this a lot lately. In AEW, Brian Cage debuts. Now he's getting a title shot already against Jon Moxley. Karrion Kross debuts in NXT. One big takeover match. Now it looks like he's on his way to challenging Adam Cole soon for the championship. We're seeing a pattern here with people just debuting and being thrusted into the championship picture. And I do wish they would pull back on that a little bit. So if that means Corbin and Riddle to give Corbin or Riddle rather a win, then I'm okay with that. Just get it out of the way, right? We knew it was inevitable. Just get it out of the way. We had another Jeff Hardy interview. Again, he was forced to admit that he is an alcoholic. He said that he's a junkie. He's a junkie for adrenaline. Ever since he was a wee little lad, he has been a junkie for adrenaline. And this Friday, Sheamus has announced that he will be having a toast to Jeff Hardy. Yes, he's going to have a toast to the alcoholic. This stuff has run its course with me. The other thing I wanted to mention about that New Day match with Lucha House Party, that was the best part of the entire match, had nothing to do with New Day or the Lucha House Party so much as it had to do with Bayley. Sasha and Bayley were on commentary for this match. And when Big E hit the belly-to-belly suplex on one of the Lucha House Party members, Bayley went nuts. She lost her mind. She's screaming, "He learned that from me. He learned that from me." Bayley is great. Bayley and Sasha are great. And we had the return of the Firefly Funhouse. Bray Wyatt, Mr. Wyers. Boy, I can't even talk anymore. Mr. Rogers Wyatt. There we go. There we go. You can see I'm running out of steam here. It's been a very long weekend of prepping for this show and now recording this show and then editing this show and getting the show up. It's getting to me here. But Bray Wyatt appeared in the Firefly Funhouse and telling everybody about how he's been doing. He joined a book club. He learned how to do TikTok, which I refuse to do. He learned how to knit, which I wish I would learn. I would like to actually learn how to knit. I would like to know, not knit. Fuck knitting. Sewing. I need to know how to sew a button. I got a button on my winter jacket that popped off. I don't know what I'm doing. One of the things I want to commit myself to here during this quarantine period is learning how to friggin' sew. So, gotta hold me to that. I gotta learn how to sew. Anyway, Ramblin' Rabbit showed up. He noted that Bray has been, actually, you've been upset, dude. You've been sulking in the corner about losing to Braun Strowman. Thankfully, Ramblin' Rabbit avoided certain death for that comment, at least so far. I'm sure he'll be killed off again at some point. But Bray talked about losing to Strowman, and Braun came down to the ring, rather, and, you know, he said, look, you had your shot. You had your shot, Bray. You had your opportunity, and you failed. Said, this is over. This game between you and me now, it's over. And Bray said, well, that chapter might be over, but I'm not lying about resurrecting the dead. Basically, we're just getting started here. And all of a sudden, we see a different scene where he morphs into the old Bray Wyatt cult leader character. And he tells Braun, you know where to find me, and all Strowman has to do is follow the buzzards, and he lifts up the lantern, he blows it out. And that's how they end it. So it looks like they're going to avoid going to the Fiend so quickly. In fact, we might get a match at Extreme Rules between Strowman and Bray, and it might be the old Bray Wyatt character. Strowman might win again. And I could see that then building to SummerSlam, which is where the Fiend... Actually, that's where the Fiend debuted a year ago, was at SummerSlam against Finn Balor, right? I believe. And then he was thrust into that championship match at Hell in a Cell with Seth Rollins. That's kind of how I see this playing out. And I did get an email from a listener. And I think it's a good comparison. Comparing Bray to Mick Foley in terms of... Mick had the three faces of Foley. He had Mankind, Dude Love, Cactus Jack. And so he was kind of drawing parallels between Bray and Foley. Because if you think about it, it's true. Bray Wyatt now has three different personalities. Three very distinct personalities. You have the original Bray Wyatt character, who very much was like a cult leader in a lot of ways. You have Funhouse Bray, who is the weakest of all the personas. I mean, he beat The Miz, but it's The Miz. It is the weakest. It is the weakest of the three personas. And then, when need be, kind of like Finn Balor and the Demon, when need be, When his back is against the wall or when he's desperate, Bray can dust off the Fiend, or he can summon the Fiend. And I think the Fiend then goes on, takes the championship from Braun Strowman. That's how I kind of see this story playing out. Right? Funhouse Bray failed. Old school Bray fails. Then the Fiend comes along and he does what the other two couldn't do. The three faces of Wyatt. So I think that's where this story is headed. AEW, just some quick notes here. There's two new signings for two people we saw on Dynamite this past Wednesday. One, and I was very excited about this, and I guess he left NWA at just the right time, Ricky Starks. Ricky Starks was the challenger for Cody's TNT Championship on Wednesday night. They had a very good match. He fell short. But he has been signed to an AEW contract. Absolute Ricky Starks. The stroke daddy is no more. According to referee Bryce Remsburg, who said that there was a legitimate discussion going on backstage about which name to use, he voted for stroke daddy. That's the name that Ricky Starks has been using for a long time. And apparently it was not his call. It was a TNT decision. I guess TNT was not fond of that name, which, you know what, especially in light of what just happened this past week, I don't know, maybe going on television and calling yourself the Stroke Daddy is not the best idea. But whatever they call him, Absolute Ricky Starks is fine. He's a talented guy. I hope he does well. I'm glad he landed in AEW. I think it's a good fit for him. Supposedly, they may already have a storyline in mind for him going forward. Hopefully, we get to see more of him on TV. He's got charisma. He can talk. Not the biggest guy in the world. I know that might turn off some people who only look at size. Size is very important. Yeah, he's not a big guy. But he has a lot of tools, I think, to be very successful. And the other signing is this new female talent named Abaddon. I had never seen Abaddon before. Abaddon had a match on AEW Dark many months ago with Hikaru Shida. Abaddon is dressed like a zombie. The contacts and the makeup and everything. She is a vile character to look at on television. I've seen Abaddon, by the way, just as a, you know, without all the makeup and everything, and she looks like a normal human being. But boy, it's like something out of The Walking Dead. This is right up my alley. It is disturbing to look at, though. Like, I'm used to seeing that. Like, I'll watch a show like The Walking Dead, or I'll watch a movie like Saw. I'll see people get their guts, like, cut out of them and stuff. And sometimes it is too much. But, like, I'm so used to seeing that in those kinds of movies, it's just kind of expected. But, I don't know, you're not used to seeing a character that looks that way with all, you know, the heavy makeup and everything in a wrestling ring. So at first, when she came crawling out through the entrance tunnel, and I'm looking, and then they zoomed in on her face, I'm like, what the fuck? I was not expecting that. And she beat poor Anna Jay. Anna Jay got a video package. She was making her big return. I thought she was going over. And she gets beat in less than 2 minutes. She loses. I didn't see that coming. But from what I understand, Abaddon, she's a good wrestler. She's got her character down pat. I don't know if she speaks or anything as part of the character, but she has been signed to a contract, so we are going to get to see more Abaddon on television. Just make sure you're not eating dinner during Dynamite, and you should be okay. The other thing I wanted to just mention here. Cody, before Ricky Starks came out for his TNT title match, Cody got on the mic, Arn Anderson got on the mic, Cody was cutting a promo, and just some of the things he said, it just strikes me, and I didn't feel this way a few weeks ago, but now, in light of some of the things that he said and little hints that he's dropped, he put the four fingers up, that was noticeable when he was scratching his face and scratching his chest. And I do believe that we're probably in the middle of some kind of slow burn heel turn for Cody and for Arn. And I wonder if we are headed... Somebody in the chat on Wednesday night, I think, was bang on with this prediction. If we are headed to something of a horseman faction, whatever they call it, they can't call it the horseman, but a horseman-type faction with Cody and Arn, FTR, which would be very interesting because FTR is feuding with Cody's buddies, right? The Young Bucks. And then you throw in Tully, who has the horseman history with Arn. Tully happens to be managing Sean Spears. And so you get all of them together, and we could have this new Four Horsemen-esque faction quite possibly on AEW television. And, you know, I think that ultimately what we're building to is having Darby Allin be the one to beat Cody to win the TNT title. Finally, he gets a win over Cody. If Cody turns heel and forms his own little faction or leads a little faction, it could actually help. You know, it could actually work into the story where Darby eventually, you know, is going to challenge him for the championship. And when he finally does, it's this big payoff where, you know, he beats the heel and finally gets that win over Cody and gets his first taste of gold in the company. So it's just some food for thought. I don't know if you guys have different thoughts on this or what you think of that idea. I'd be down for that. I mean, I'd be down for that idea. But it was something that was very noticeable watching the show on Wednesday night. And then we have NXT. NXT on Wednesday was a homecoming for Bayley and Sasha Banks. Bayley and the Boss, women's tag team champions, defending their titles against Tegan Nox and Shotzi Blackheart. But first, we had Imperium defending the NXT tag team titles against Breezango. I would not have put the titles on Breezango. Thankfully, they didn't do it here either. There was a point in the match where Inda Sher, that's Malcolm Bivens' team, they come walking out. Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan come out. They attack them. Fandango had a roll-up, but he didn't know that Fabian Aichner was actually the legal man. He had the wrong guy pinned. And Aichner hit a DDT on him, and they retained their titles. Velveteen Dream. And again, there's a lot of allegations and things that are swirling around Velveteen Dream, who did not win the NXT Championship. And I wonder, when all of this is said and done, however this gets resolved, if we're going to look back at that decision and say, okay, now it makes sense why they didn't put the title on him when it seemed like this is what they had been building to. was putting the championship unless he was getting called up, and obviously he wasn't. Why wouldn't they put the title on Velveteen Dream? Well, we may know soon enough, but Velveteen Dream was doing a split screen with Tom Phillips. And as Velveteen Dream is talking, Dexter Lumis pops up. He pops his head up from behind the couch that Velveteen Dream is sitting on, and he places a drawing next to him. And it's a drawing of the two of them holding the NXT Tag Team titles. And Dream sees the photo, he's looking at it, or he sees the drawing and he's looking at it. And he says, Dream's a solo act. He basically dismisses the idea of it, but you know that that's obviously where this is probably heading. And they may well end up as the tag team champions. Look, we've seen Dexter Lumis draw things before that have become real. Right? He had a drawing a couple weeks ago before TakeOver of, I think, him in the car driving the Undisputed Era, and then at TakeOver, he put Bobby Fish and Roderick Strong in the trunk of his car and drove off with them. So this is probably a foreshadowing of what's to come. We had Aaliyah against Xia Li. This was not good. Robert Stone, he was looking very rough. He was all disheveled, and he had the brown bag special in his hand. He looked like he had a rough night, and a rough morning, and a rough afternoon, and a rough evening. Just a rough time for Robert Stone after he was fired by Chelsea Green and he was rebuffed by Rhea Ripley. And this was the sort of thing you would see on, like, fucking Raw, where in the middle of the match, Robert Stone is on the apron because Aaliyah has been, I don't know if she's hoping to become a client of his, I think that's the story. He vomited. Now, I prefer that we keep the bodily fluids and functions on Raw and SmackDown where they belong. And not on NXT. But he vomited, and that led to Aaliyah roll. Now, this was very weird. This whole thing was a clusterfuck, because clearly the finish was going to be the guy throws up, and Xia Li is mortified by this. She's watching Robert Stone. She then gets rolled up and pinned, right? So she gets rolled up, but then she kicks out. And then Aaliyah just keeps covering her, and then she gets the pin. So I don't know. It sounds to me like Xia Li got confused. Whoever's fault it was, this sucked. All of this sucked. I didn't like this. I'll tell you what I did like. This I liked. They had a vignette with Timothy Thatcher, who's doing a new gimmick. He was like a coach. It's like a wrestling coach. And he brought in some students. We just, you know, faceless names. We didn't get to see their faces, but he lines them up and he's teaching them how to do certain moves. He's stretching them. He's torturing them. He's basically Stu Hart in the dungeon. Puts one guy in a Fujiwara armbar, and he, you know, obviously he's really cinching down on it, and the guy, I thought he was going to break the guy's arm. And he dismissed the class at the end, and I hope this becomes a weekly thing. I think Thatcher is perfect for this type of character. Then we had therapy time with Undisputed Era. They had a therapy session because Roderick Strong is terrified of Dexter Lumis. Everywhere he looks, he's always seeing Lumis. He's being terrorized by this poor guy. And so Adam Cole and Bobby Fish, they bring him to a shrink who actually is Kyle O'Reilly, dressed up as some kind of old man. I guess Roderick Strong doesn't know that it's Kyle O'Reilly as the doctor. He's doing some weird accent. And anyway, he's asking him questions, and he's giving him the Rorschach test and holding up this. What do you see here? And all he sees in a lot of the things is, it's him. One photo has what is supposed to be, I don't know what it's supposed to be, but it looked like a car. It looked like a car trunk, and he freaked out. He says, oh my God, that's the trunk. Sees Lumis, he freaks out. This all ends with him agreeing to go outside. And I guess they're going to have him get into the trunk of a car. I guess to face his fears. Why would anybody have to go in the trunk of a car? Like, nobody should be going into the trunk of a car anyway. So why would you force this poor guy who's already traumatized, and these are his friends, to climb into the trunk of a car? Like, I wouldn't do that. If my friends told me to climb into the trunk of the car, they wouldn't be my friends anymore. I would tell them to piss off and I would walk away. So he started going, and then he just bolted in the other direction. I actually laughed at this. he took off as fast as his feet could carry him. And they had a camera, you know, on the other end, and you could just see Roddy running. He was sprinting down the street. I did laugh at that. This was very goofy and very dumb, but I will admit, when he went running, I did laugh. Adam Cole had an in-ring promo. After all the comedy, it was time to get serious now. Adam Cole's in the ring, and, you know, Keith Lee has made it very clear that he wants a crack at the NXT Championship, and Adam Cole said, well, I want the North American Championship. And that brought out Keith Lee, that brought out Johnny Gargano, who lost it in your house, but he still wants a shot at the title. Finn Balor followed. He wants the North American title, since it's a title he's never held before. And they're all going back and forth. William Regal pops up on Zoom or Skype or whatever service he's using. And he announces that this Wednesday, Keith Lee will defend the North American Championship against both Johnny Gargano and Finn Balor in a triple threat match. The winner of that match, whoever leaves as the North American champion, will go on to defend against Adam Cole on the July 8th episode of NXT in a winner-take-all champion versus champion title-for-title match. July 8th just so happens to be week 2, the finale of AEW Fighter Fest on TNT. Now look, there's nothing wrong with trying to stack the deck with a big main event. I would probably do the same thing. I'm just saying, it is no coincidence that they are building to a winner-take-all championship match on July 8th. So, that's how they're going to try to counteract AEW. And as far as the outcome, you know, winner takes both belts, who wins? I mean, there's a lot of different ways you could go with this. There's a lot of different ways that you could go with this. You could have Finn Balor win the North American title. Maybe Johnny Gargano does something to, you know, to screw Keith Lee at the last second or something. And then it's Balor and Cole, champion against champion, title for title. And maybe Balor wins. Maybe Balor is winner take all and he has both titles. And it's in fact not going to be Karrion Kross coming after Adam Cole, which is weird because again, that's heel versus heel. But maybe they're trying to get the title on Finn Balor, who, he was a heel, now I guess he's a babyface again, or a tweener, or whatever he's supposed to be. Maybe they're building to Karrion Kross and Finn Balor. Or maybe they go all the way with Keith Lee. Keith Lee retains, and then he does in fact go on to wrestle Adam Cole. And Keith Lee could win the championship. And then go on to face Karrion Kross, but then you're going to put the title on Keith Lee. And then have him drop it to Karrion Kross. You're going to have a lot of very pissed off fans, I think, if you do that. That's not really fair to Keith Lee. So I don't know what they're going to do. It is an interesting scenario that they have set up here. I will say. It is a very interesting scenario. And I think if it were up to me, it really depends on what they want to do with Karrion Kross. I mean, are they going to make Karrion Kross a fan favorite already? Are they going to make him a fan favorite firmly? Because if so, then I think there's nothing wrong with having him take the title from Adam Cole. If Cole is going to, you know, or Undisputed Era is going to move on to Raw or SmackDown, because what else is left for them to do, for God's sakes, in NXT? I mean, that's a move that I can actually support. And I don't know how they're going to do on the main roster. Believe me, I'm worried. It's not a surefire success for any of those guys if they get moved to the main roster. And yeah, I say main roster. I guess NXT would be technically considered that now too. But to move them to Raw, to move them to SmackDown, yes, anything can happen. Once you're in the hands of Vince McMahon, a lot of bad things could happen. And Adam Cole, we already heard the comments from Road Dogg. I'm sure he's not the only one in that company who feels that way about Adam Cole's physical size. I don't know what kind of future he has on Raw or SmackDown, but I know this. What is left for him to do? Other than maybe go babyface in NXT. What is left for him in the Undisputed Era to do? You know, Finn Balor still has a lot of cachet. He's still a big name on that roster. But if the idea in bringing him in was in part, you know, to have him work with some of the newer faces, like he did with Damian Priest. And Damian Priest lost that match, but he got a lot from Finn Balor. That was an excellent match. He won even though he lost. But if the idea is that in the end, you know, Balor is going to help put some of these newer faces over, I don't know that it's the worst idea in the world to have Finn Balor be the one to go all the way to challenge Adam Cole, win the championship, and then, yeah, the next person in line might be Karrion Kross. And maybe Karrion Kross takes the championship from Finn Balor, and they go all the way with the big, you know, they put the rocket on Karrion Kross, and they kind of send him to the moon and let him, you know, beat Finn Balor, let Finn Balor put him over. I don't think that's such a bad idea, if that's the direction they wanted to go in. But, you know, what they do is really going to be dictated by what their plans are for some of these guys. I don't know who might be called to a different brand. I don't know if anyone's going to be turning. If they do, that changes my whole prediction. But I like that. I like the fact that I don't know where they're going to go next. I think that's a good thing. It makes things a little unpredictable. Unpredictability can be a very good thing. We got a Mercedes Martinez vignette. She's coming back. We haven't seen her in a while, but Mercedes Martinez is coming back. I think she's a great addition to the women's division, so can't say anything bad about getting her back on TV. We have the new Cruiserweight champion, Santos Escobar, cut a promo. He does, in fact, speak fluent English. Vince McMahon is going to have Charlotte lock Andrade in her father's liquor cabinet and replace him with Escobar. He'll just randomly pop up on Raw one week with Zelina Vega. They'll hope we don't even notice. He was flanked by his two ninja friends, Raul Mendoza and Joaquin Wilde. Escobar talked about, you know, his father, Fantasma, telling him that he would be a leader, he would not be a luchador. He vowed to teach Mendoza and Wilde how to be leaders. You know, and it was a good promo. The guy can talk. Drake Maverick, he came out, he interrupted. He went after them, he got a few kicks in, and of course he was overwhelmed by the numbers. He did a tope, he got beaten down though at ringside, and Escobar gave Maverick the Phantom Driver off of the stage or a platform they have there, down through a table. And they loaded him onto a stretcher during the commercial break and took him away. And then we had the women's tag team titles on the line in the main event. Tegan Nox and Shotzi Blackheart challenging Sasha Banks and Bayley back at Full Sail. It's not the same without there being the Full Sail crowd, but you could tell that it was a cool thing for them to be back in that place, and they had their working shoes on here in this match. And it was a good match. I thought they would do the title change, but they didn't. But they had a very good match. And we had Sasha countering a doomsday device. Only she got hit by a missile dropkick right after that. So she kicked out of a pin. She had transitioned into the bank statement. Shotzi escaped. She put the cattle mutilation submission on Sasha. Bayley got in the ring with a chair to break things up, but Tegan cut her off and took the chair. Now, the referee saw Tegan holding the chair, and she was yelling at her for it. While the referee is admonishing her and has his attention focused on Tegan, Bayley breaks up the submission hold, and Sasha then reapplies the bank statement. Shotzi has no choice but to tap out. Sasha and Bayley retain, and they're celebrating when all of a sudden out comes the NXT Women's Champion, Io Shirai. She knocks down Bayley with a springboard dropkick, and she goes after Sasha, and she suplexes them, and running knee strikes to both of them, and clears the ring and stands tall. I am very much on board with a singles match at some point between Io Shirai and Sasha Banks. I have no idea if that's the direction they're thinking of. Give me Sasha versus Io, and I will be a happy man. So, I think, when I look at this show, I think that the core on NXT right now is strong. They've got Adam Cole, they've got Finn Balor, they've got Keith Lee, they've got Johnny Gargano, Tommaso Ciampa. He isn't really in the picture at the moment, but he's still there. He's still lurking. Karrion Kross looks to be main event bound very soon. Damian Priest, he's, you know, getting a push now as a babyface. Timothy Thatcher has the shooter gimmick. Escobar is leading a new faction. Mercedes Martinez is on her way back to the women's division. Io's got the title. It's right where it belongs. Charlotte is gone. Hooray. Rhea Ripley is still there. I mean, you've got a lot of good pieces in place. It just comes down to how you put the pieces together. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. There's going to be a lot more news about various things, I'm sure, coming out throughout the week. And any updates that I can provide, that would be the place that I would provide you with them. And, of course, you could join me on Tuesday night, 8 p.m. on YouTube. I'm going to be doing my final review for Chapter 5 of The Undertaker, The Last Ride, which I'm going to be watching here in just a little bit. I'm going to take a breather, have a little lunch, and go catch up on the final Undertaker episode before it gets spoiled for me. I hope that you enjoyed the show this week. I know a lot of the content was kind of dark and it was heavier than usual, and I did not get into the RSPW. I didn't get to the mailbag questions, although I am still pulling them and I'm putting the mailbag together, but that's not what this week was about. This week was about a lot more than that. It was a lot of important stuff to cover. And hopefully you come away from this show feeling that you are more informed, at least about what's going on, because there's so much information that's going around. And look, I don't know everything either. All I can do is the best job that I can do in trying to distill it down to what I feel is the most important stuff, the most accurate stuff at this moment that we know of, keep the other stuff out of it, and give my thoughts and my opinion about the situation. You don't have to agree with it. You may have a different opinion, but I hope you got something out of the show this week. Enjoyed it. I don't know if enjoy is the right word, given the subject matter. But in any event, hopefully you did enjoy the show this week. And we'll be back next week, episode 658. Hopefully not quite as heavy on the subject matter that we had to talk about this week. But I got a feeling this is not the last of this. So this story is going to continue on for a while. There may be more damaging things coming out, more disgusting claims coming out, and we will cover them as they need to be covered, because this is not the sort of thing that should be ignored. Can't turn a blind eye to this, not anymore. I'll see you on YouTube Tuesday night, again live for the AEW stream on Wednesday night, and right back here for episode 658 next Sunday. If you like what you heard, it's always helpful to, you know, go on iTunes or any of these different services, leave a review for the podcast, support the show in any way that you can. Happy Father's Day again to all the dads. I know we have a lot of them listening to this show each and every week, and I hope that you enjoy the day. I know these are very challenging times. Can't exactly go out and do all the things that you normally might want to do on Father's Day, but hopefully you have a great day. And again, to Brian Blade, if you're listening, and I know he is, happy Father's Day to him, and congrats again on the little one, and hopefully I will get to see all of you very soon. Until next time, take care, guys. Have a great week.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Jericho losing his mind. He kept going off on Pineapple Pete. He couldn't stand Pineapple Pete. I don't like pineapple. I think pineapple is disgusting. That's right, I said it. I don't like pineapple. And you know what's worse than pineapple? Pineapple on pizza? What kind of savage would even think of such a thing? This doesn't make sense to me.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.